This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK5.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 96. It's a different playground. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including tour plans for Star Trek The Exhibition, new developments in the possible remastering of Deep Space Nine, Diamond Select's USS Excelsior, Geek Nation Tours, Hollywood to Vegas with Larry Nemechek, and Star Trek Ongoing number 20. Plus, Mike Schindler gives a report from the midnight screening of Into Darkness at the BFI IMAX in London. Then in the feature, we're joined by Charlene Schmidt and Max Hegel to discuss the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek film. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Matthew. How are you doing this week?
You know, Chris, I'm doing really good. It was just been a busy week, really. Something that was really fun. I got a chance to do something I haven't really done a lot of before. But I got to talk to a podcast about that other Star franchise. But they had me on because they wanted to talk about Star Trek. You know, JJ now is going to the dark side or to the Star Trek. From Star Trek to Star Wars, and they wanted to just talk about that and his work here, and also they do a podcast about the Star Wars literary universe and Star Wars in general. And so the guys over at Temple Archives, they had me on. It was so much fun just kind of get the pump primed to be able to talk about 2009. This week on the Ready Room, and so I feel like I really prepared by getting to talk through some of those issues with those guys, and now we're going to talk about it with Max and Char in the future. So it's been a really busy week, a big Star Trek week, and then of course,
did you tell them that you're excited about seeing the offspring of Keenzer and Jar Jar and how their baby is going to grow up, of course, to jump into the timeline of Star Wars Episode 7, but he's going to play kind of that Jar Jar role from The Phantom Menace.
Yeah, I think that's going to be actually pretty good. And
yeah, Keenstar he's going to be quite a character.
Which is weird because I'm pretty sure that Keenzer, you know, the reason he's so short is he's just related to hobbits.
I'm going on an adventure!
And so I think that that's why, you know, he's so diminutive. You know, a hobbit had kind of walked through some sort of time loop warp thing and, mixed with some other alien, and that's how we got Keenzer. Actually, I think that's what happened in the ongoing comic, wasn't it, Chris? With Keenzer?
That was his backstory? Something like that.
Okay, yeah.
Makes sense to me. I'm going with it. It's now part of my personal canon.
Excellent.
All right. Well, why don't we jump into our Star Trek news? We have a few items this week, and we're not going to have as much Into Darkness news at the end of the segment as we usually do, since it's now in theaters. Many people have seen it. It's been premiering everywhere. But what we do have coming up this summer and in autumn are new tour dates for Star Trek The Exhibition. Now, this is something I would love to be able to attend, but of course I can't because I'm here in Japan. Matthew, have you ever been to Star Trek The Exhibition, or would you like to go there if it were to come close enough to you there in Texas?
Goodness, I would love to go to this. You know, I have never been to Vegas when they had the Star Trek Experience, and of course they had a lot of memorabilia there. I never got a chance to go. And so, you know, that kind of hurt my heart a little bit, honestly. And this has not been anywhere near the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I'm very disappointed that they really haven't done that. And I wish they would have. I mean, Dallas has the Texas State Fair every year at the end of September and into October. Would have been a perfect place to have this come. We have two science places. We have a natural history museum here in Dallas. I mean, plenty of places they could have had this. Yeah, just really disappointed because the stuff in here looks great. I mean, costumes and props and, I mean, just all the things you'd love to be able to see up close.
Yeah, I have a feeling that eventually you will get it. You know, science centers are places where it has set up in the past. The St. Louis Science Center was there. It was also in Kentucky. And in those cases, it ran for a long time. It ran for like 6 months, 5 or 6 months. It was back from October in 2011 to May 2012 is when it was at the St. Louis Science Center. And those are wonderful because it gives everyone in the general area an opportunity to get there without having to figure out, like, how am I going to swing it this weekend or next weekend?
Right.
So hopefully you'll get it. What they have coming up in summer of this year and in autumn are three stops on the West Coast for those who haven't seen it. Because again, it's been in Florida, it's been in Kentucky, it's been in Missouri. But now people in California and Arizona will be able to take in Star Trek the Exhibition. On June 8th, it's going to land at the San Diego County Fair, and it's going to stay there until July 7th. Next, it's going to go to the Los Angeles County Fair from August 30th to September 29th. And then finally, it's going to go to the Arizona State Fair from October 11th to November 3rd. So lots of fairs, which means lots of... What do you guys have in Texas? You like deep fry everything at the fair there, don't
oh,
you?
Oh, my
like
goodness.
Deep fried margaritas. And
we have... I mean, my favorite when I go to the state fair is deep fried cheesecake, deep fried cookie dough, chocolate chip cookie dough, which is fantastic, and deep fried chocolate is really good as well. Those are my favorites. And then deep fried autumn pie, which is just deep fried pumpkin pie. Oh my gosh, Chris. It's so good.
I've also heard of deep fried Coca-Cola. Now, what is this?
You know, the worst, yeah, deep fried Coca-Cola, what they usually do is they create some kind of like a ravioli and they inject it with a syringe with Coke. Or they also did this with beer. And then they deep fry it. The deep fried beer was disgusting because all it was is you would bite into the ravioli and this warm beer squirts out in your mouth and it's gross. So yeah, it did not work. You can't deep fry everything and it'd be better.
It sounds like something that they need to sell after they have sold someone half a dozen cold beers. And at that point, they'll just eat or drink pretty much anything. I think that when Star Trek the Exhibition comes eventually to the State Fair in Texas, they need to have Star Trek themed dishes, you know, like deep fried Leola root, for example.
See, there you go. Some deep fried gach might be good.
Yeah.
You know, deep fried blood wine. We've really got something going here. I think this
inject a ravioli with blood wine.
Exactly.
And you deep fry it, right?
Exactly.
It's a warrior's meal.
I don't
meal.
Know how much. I mean, blood wine is already served at room temperature, so this might actually work better than beer.
You know what I'd like to have instead of autumn pie would be some deep fried cellular peptide cake with mint frosting. Deep fried, of course.
As long as it looks like Troy, I'll probably eat it.
Well, I have a feeling that you're not going to be getting deep fried dishes at any of these fairs in California. I doubt it. So, but you will be able to take in all the sights at Star Trek the Exhibition, and they've got a lot of cool stuff there. You know, they've got replicas of the bridge from TOS, for example, captain's chair. You can get your photo taken there. Sick bay, Quark's bar.
No. Not just sick bay. Crusher's sick bay. So I'm really hoping that, you know, Crusher is there and I could get my picture taken with her. You know how much I love my Beverly.
Yeah, I have a feeling that Matthew is going to make himself sick, going to intentionally catch something that needs treatment before he goes to this event. And you're hoping Gates is going to be there, right, to treat you. You're going to go in, you're going to lay down. They're going to say you can't touch anything on the set, but you're going to lay down on the table anyway and just wait for Dr. Crusher to come over.
Mm-hmm. Let her treat me. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if you know this, Chris, but today on Twitter was Team Bev Day, where everyone was trying to get more followers for Gates McFadden, who just had joined Twitter, which, welcome to Twitter, Gates McFadden. We're so glad that you're finally here with us. And she's been really sweet to the fans. She's been very interactive. And so, yes, of course, I would love it if, you know, visiting Crusher's sick bay, if Beverly Crusher, my favorite sci-fi mom, was actually there. And so, probably not, but oh well.
Probably not, but you can hope. So, if you want to find out, you can go either to the San Diego County Fair, the Los Angeles County Fair, or the Arizona State Fair. Now, Arizona's not too far away from you, right? How many hours is that? Like a 5-6 hour drive?
Oh, gosh. No, Chris.
Things are big in Texas.
Yeah. If I were to drive from Dallas to, like, say, Phoenix, it is a 2-day drive. So
is it that far? Okay.
It's very far. In fact, most of that, too, is through Texas. It's a big state.
Yeah. Well, it's just like, you know, Riker said to Worf, you Klingons don't do anything small, do you? It's the same way in Texas.
Exactly. From the hats to the boot to the state itself.
All right. Well, if you want more information about this, we'll put a link in the show notes, and you can find out, you know, when tickets go on sale, how to get your tickets. And it's nice that it's going to be in each location for a month, so you'll have enough time to try to get over there if you're in the general area. Now, Matthew, moving on to the next story, this is something you and I have speculated on, we've talked about, and when Trek Corps published this story, I was so excited to see this. It's some news about the feasibility of remastering Deep Space Nine for Blu-ray.
Chris, I saw this and I was immediately reading it. I was so excited to see that there was any information about how this might come to fruition. You know, Deep Space Nine, I think we know that it's going to look fantastic when it is remastered, but we also know intrinsically it's going to be a lot harder than TNG, where they use all model shots, and it's very easy for them to recomposite those. Digital files don't always stay around, you know, and with the way effects houses have moved around and gotten, you know, they've had to go out of business and all of that kind of stuff, things are a lot different. When, you know, in DS9 you're using model shots plus CGI, it makes it really difficult. But they actually showed a picture of one of the upgraded high-res ships, and goodness, does this look good. I mean, wow.
It's amazing, yes. Now, Trek Corps was talking to Robert Bonchun, and I may be mispronouncing his name, but he was the senior CG supervisor, and he worked on DS9, Voyager, and Enterprise, the post-TNG spinoffs. And fortunately, he actually still has possession of all the original CG scene files that he worked on during all of his time on Star Trek. I mean, you talk about just luck, you know. It's finding all the film negatives for TNG, I think, was lucky as well, because we know that Paramount had sold off so much stuff from Star Trek over the years. And when you deal with that amount of material, also, you know, it's easy, even if you try very hard to keep things filed and organized, it's easy to lose things. But like you said, Matthew, digital files are much easier to lose than film. And it's amazing to me that he still has all of these files. Now, I gathered from reading the Trek Corps article that he may not have worked on every single scene in the show, so they may find that there are certain things that they don't have. But anything he worked on, he has it. And he said that anything that his teams worked on was purposely overproduced, and they put in so much detail that they knew would never be seen in SD. But like any good artist, any good designer, they still paid attention to those details anyway. And so the ship you're talking about here is the USS Honshu, which we see in the episode Waltz when they're transporting Gul Dukat. And my goodness, we're going to put a link to this in the show notes. We're going to put this as the enhanced art, but you really need to go over to TrekCore and actually click on it so you can see the full-size image of the Honshu. It is absolutely stunning. And all he did was he just took the original file and he re-rendered it for TrekCore as an example of what they would be able to do. And wow, I'm really excited now.
And, this will be a lot of work, Deep Space Nine, depending on if they can find these files or not. You know, hopefully they can find most of them. And otherwise, you do kind of run into a TOS where you would have to recreate these from scratch. And that is difficult. I mean, it's easier today. The software makes it easier and it's faster, but that's still also a lot of work. And so, those later seasons of Deep Space Nine that are CGI heavy, especially when you have 50 to 100 ships all interworking together in some big battle scene. I mean, that's just a lot of work.
Yeah, it is. And that's one thing that Bun Shun points out. He says Deep Space Nine is much more difficult for the last three seasons because of the combination of CG and motion control, because they did have these massive battle scenes. And he says, and when there was CG, it was usually those massive full-blown war scenes. Going back and revisiting it isn't as simple as just hitting render, like he did for the Honshu. But he says it's still pretty straightforward, as long as they have the original files.
So hopefully they'll start looking for these files and really looking into, getting Deep Space Nine remastered. I think that this also speaks to CBS that, if they really do plan on doing DS9, it might be better for them to start this project earlier rather than later, because Deep Space Nine could entail more work than even TNG is.
I think the later seasons definitely will take a lot more time to prepare than the TNG sets are. But that's what he says. What I gathered from reading the TrekCore article was it wasn't so much a matter of them finding all the files. He has all the files. He was saying that it's up to CBS to contact him if they want to do the project, because if they contact him, they'll be able to remaster DS9 for far less money than it would cost if they were to start over from scratch, which is pretty much what they would have to do with a lot of those later seasons, is just to start over from scratch. Mm-hmm. And I have to think that absolutely CBS is going to contact him. They're going to get the files. They're going to remaster DS9. I can't imagine that they wouldn't do it. And so it just has me really, really excited, because it's the one thing that I've worried about is how are they going to do those scenes? Are they going to have to just take the existing footage and up-res it? Or do they somehow have access to the original files where they can re-render them? Or are they going to start over from scratch? And so it looks like the path to a remastered DS9 just got a lot easier.
Yeah, this is great news. And, you, Chris, and I are both Niners, and so just can't wait to see Deep Space Nine in Blu-ray. If the TNG Blu-rays are anything that we can hope for, I can see Deep Space Nine just really blowing us out of the water once it's finally put in high definition. This is going to look fantastic.
It definitely will. Yeah, I've been watching Enterprise on Blu-ray, and Enterprise already was a lot clearer than the other shows, having been shot in HD. But I was watching Dear Doctor the other day, and I was just noticing the detail work on Phlox's hands, and it's something that I had never really paid attention to when I watched the show in SD. And I was looking at it, and I was thinking, Michael Westmore is amazing. That there's so much detail in the alien designs, even on Phlox's hands, in areas that are normally covered up by sleeves. And that comes out on Enterprise. And think about all the amazing one-off aliens that Westmore did for DS9. And just being able to see that stuff in Blu-ray, it's going to be amazing. So we'll put a link to the TrekCore article in the show notes. I really encourage you to go over, read that, and look at this re-rendering of the Honshu, because you'll really be blown away by this ship. Matthew, let me ask you a question. If I told you that you could go to Vasquez Rocks and you could fight a Gorn, what would you say? Would you want to do something like that?
Wow, Chris, if I could go to Vasquez Rocks and fight a Gorn, why wouldn't I want to do that? I mean, sign me up right now.
Right. I mean, who wouldn't want to fight a Gorn? I'd probably like to fight him more like Shatner does in the commercial for the new video game, where they're having a pillow fight in the living room as they play on the PlayStation. I might like that a little bit more than actually fighting on the rocks, but still, I mean, if I could go and do that, and if I could fight Bobby Clark, I mean, what Star Trek fan wouldn't want to do that? And you can do that if you sign up for Geek Nation Tours, Exploring Trek Sites Hollywood to Vegas with Larry Nemechek. Now, this is the second year in a row that Larry is leading this tour, along with Geek Nation Tours, starting in Los Angeles and going over to Las Vegas. And it's an opportunity for you to see sites that were used in the filming of Star Trek, TOS, TNG, the movies, DS9, Voyager, Enterprise, lots of famous sites. And they're mixing it up. You know, they're not all the same sites as last year. They like to take you to different places. And you're going to be able to see these places firsthand, as well as get, you know, hands-on information from Larry himself. And they're also going to have other people like Michael Westmore and Bobby Clark joining in certain locations this year.
This is definitely something, Chris, that I would like to do. I mean, if I had the time and the money, it would just be fantastic to be able to do this. You know, going to all these great sites and then ending up at Star Trek Las Vegas with all of this in your mind as you're getting to see all of the actors, and what a great experience. And so, you know, if you can make this happen, this is something that every Star Trek fan, I think, should try to do.
It is really a great opportunity for Star Trek fans, and it has a limited number of seats. Only 35 seats are available on this tour. So, you know, if you want to get in, you should go over to geeknationtours.com and register now. And it includes a lot. You know, you get 6 nights at the Rio, which is, of course, where Star Trek Las Vegas is taking place. You get your transportation on the buses. You get your entrance fees to most venues where you'll stop along the tour. Those are included in your package. You get lunches on days 3 and 4. You get a tour of Paramount Studios, the Valley of Fire. Your airport transfers to and from the hotels and tour guide service are included. And, of course, you get a lot of little memorabilia items like t-shirts and towels and some discount vouchers from Creation. And taxes are included as well. And you'll end up ultimately at the convention at Star Trek Las Vegas, where you'll be staying at the Rio. And it's altogether actually a 10-day tour if you include the convention.
Yeah, this is something that, you know, I can't imagine not doing if I had the, you know, the time and the money. This would be a once-in-a-lifetime kind of trip. So definitely look this up, because I don't think that you would be sad spending this much time with Larry telling you everything he knows about Star Trek, which, as we know, when he's on the Ready Room, is always fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. Now, last year, I tried to get Larry to agree to dress up as a Gorn and fight people himself at Vasquez Rocks. I don't think that happened. This year, Bobby Clark is going to be there for the visit to Vasquez Rocks, and so I guess there's no need for Larry to dress up in that case. So a quick rundown of the days for you, what you'll be doing. The first day, you get to go to Cafe Siroc, which is actually Siroc Lofton, or Jake Sisko's restaurant, and the Sarah Wine Bar, and then the Griffith Observatory. Now, I don't know if Sarah Silverman is going to be there or not, searching for aliens, but you know, maybe she is, and maybe you could pull a Tom Paris and strike up a conversation with her.
You never know. As we know, Sarah Silverman is a fan of geeky guys that are kind of out of place. So you could end up with your one and only wife.
Could be, yeah. So second day, you'll go to the J.J. Abrams Academy at Cal State Northridge, the Oviatt Library, the Tillman Water Plant and Japanese Garden, which is Starfleet Academy and Starfleet Headquarters, Will Rogers State Historic Park, which is the landing spot of the Bird of Prey in Star Trek IV. Even though they're landing in San Francisco, that was actually shot down there around L.A. And then the Santa Monica Pier, which is, as we were just talking about, from the episode Future's End on Voyager. And then on the third day, you'll head out to Bronson Canyon, which served as Rurapente, the setting for Darmok, and also was seen in Bread and Circuses. The Franklin Canyon Park, which was seen in the Paradise Syndrome, tour the Paramount Studios, and go to Grauman's Chinese Theater. Now, Matthew, day four, where will people be going?
Well, you're going to get to go to the Vasquez Rocks County Park and meet Bobby Clark, which would be fantastic. Reenact maybe some of those scenes from Arena. And then you're going to go to Club Ed, the movie ranch, where they film the Q Continuum and Death Wish. That's where you got to see parts of the Q Continuum and Death Wish. So that's really exciting.
Yeah, that was interesting how they portrayed the Q Continuum.
Yeah, I thought it was. It gave a nice feel to trying to dumb down the continuum for our puny human brains, and just seemed like something Q would think up to make us feel stupider than we actually are.
Exactly. Well, you'll wrap it up day five, going to the Valley of Fire State Park with Michael Westmore. Now, this is where they filmed the Viridian 3 scenes from Generations. It's the final resting place of Captain James T. Kirk. And then you'll arrive in Las Vegas. And then from there, the next 5 days, days 6 through 10, are all there at Star Trek Las Vegas. There are special optional get-togethers at night. So if you want to hang out with the other group members from the tour, you can do that. And then on day 10, you'll be heading home. Now, the tour is kind of pricey if you just thinking of it as a number. It's $2,699 based on double occupancy. There's a deposit of $350, which is due on June 15th if you sign up. But of course, you're getting a lot of transportation. You're getting all these nights in the hotel for that price. So, a lot of money that you would be spending to go to the Star Trek Las Vegas convention is already rolled up in this price.
Yeah, this is something that, again, I think if you can do this, I would do it. I mean, I would be on this tour if I could make this a possibility for myself. It just sounds like one of those things that you would be talking about for the rest of your life. And, you know, getting to meet, with Larry in person, getting to meet Michael Westmore, which I think would just be fantastic. The work that he did on Star Trek and the Aliens was just amazing. And then, of course, visiting Sirach's restaurant, all of these things, I can't imagine having more fun.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating. I would love to go. And if you want to go, we'll put a link in the show notes and in the enhanced tier. Or you can also go over to geeknationtours.com and click on the upcoming tours at the top of the page. And then you'll see it there. Exploring Star Trek sites, Hollywood to Vegas with Larry Nemechek, August 3rd through 12th. Click on there, and there is a lot of information, a very long page full of every detail about the tour. And we'll help you sign up as well if you want to join. Matthew, how's your Starship collection doing these days?
You know, it's doing really well, Chris. I haven't added anything in a while. The Starship budget had really been depleted with all that had been brought to me, the Enterprise E, the Enterprise B, and the Enterprise D. But it looks like, Chris, maybe there's a new Starship on the horizon for me.
Oh my, I think there is, and it's none other than the USS Excelsior with audio from George Takei. And that's coming from Diamond Select as well, sculpted by Art Asylum. And this is a 16-inch long ship. Now, Matthew, you have the Enterprise B, mm-hmm. and if I recall correctly, your Enterprise B actually came with Excelsior stickers on it. Is that right?
Yes, it did, Chris. It did come with the Excelsior markings on the side. But finally, Diamond Select sent me the decal sheet to fix that problem. So it'll say Enterprise B now. So that was very nice of them to create these and send them out to the fans. It doesn't bother me all that much. It's kind of funny that it says that, and you can hardly see it. But it clearly does. If you look close enough, it says Excelsior on the Enterprise B. So
you can barely see it. So Matthew, are you living your life in SD? You need to live your life in HD.
Well, Chris, I think what it was is I forgot my 3D glasses there at the theater the other day when I was seeing, The Great Gatsby in 3D. I left them there, and so everything's been a little bit fuzzy.
I hate when that happens. So is this Excelsior model that's coming out, is this the same size as the Enterprise B that you have? Or is this a different, maybe like a more, I don't know the word I want to use, like a more consumer model as opposed to a collector's model?
Actually, the models that they've been doing are really good. The Enterprise E, the paint job for the Nemesis version is fantastic. The Enterprise B looks very much like it does in the film. It's really well done. It is between, I think, kind of the consumer model and a more collector's item. If you like, the Starfleet ships and you'd like good representations of them without paying, over $100, these are fantastic. You will not be sad that you got one of these ships. And so I'm very excited to see that they're doing the Excelsior because so many people love this ship.
Yeah, I like the Excelsior too. I've always liked that ship, and I was glad that they used the Excelsior class as the basis for the Enterprise B. I remember in Generations when the champagne bottle is tumbling through space and when it hit the side of the B and they pan out, and I thought, yes, I love this ship design. And I like the changes that they made to it for the Enterprise B as well, but I also love the Excelsior.
Yeah, it has great lines. I always just think of the beautiful shots of the Excelsior in the beginning of Star Trek VI, and mm-hmm. the model looks fantastic. And the ship design of the Excelsior was always something I felt like was a good take on, the Constitution class ship, but kind of extrapolating and just doing something different with those, features. And it's a good ship. It's a great design. So this will be fantastic, I think, with the rest of my models.
Excellent. So you're going to buy this one?
We'll see. I'd like to have it, but the other problem is that I'm running out of space of where to put them.
You need to hang them from your ceiling.
Well, yeah, and I can do that. There are some that I'd like to have more than the Excelsior, like the Defiance or Deep Space Nine, something like that. And the other thing is I already have the Excelsior in the sense that I have the Enterprise B, so it's not all that different.
Yeah. I know what you're really waiting for. You're waiting for the Diamond Select USS Pasteur because you're hoping that Beverly Crusher will deliver it to your door.
That would be fantastic. Well, and who doesn't love a ship that, saucer section is just a huge ball? I mean,
exactly.
It looks like a child put it together. Oh, goodness.
Yeah. Although I have to think that that's not an unrealistic design for a starship, though. If we were going to build a ship that wasn't going to go into battle anyway.
Yeah, well, and it also would seem to be a ship design that you might see in a sci-fi movie where they're having to create their own artificial gravity so that, maybe an outside ball would be moving so the inside ball had gravity. So, yeah, I could actually see that that making sense. But as a Starfleet ship, it looks a little ridiculous.
But if Beverly delivers it to you by hand, you won't complain about the ship design.
No. Bev could pretty much, deliver me anything by hand. I'd be excited.
All right. Well, we'll put a link in the show notes to this as well if you'd like to take a look. There's actually a little video over on StarTrek.com of them handling the Diamond Select Excelsior as well. So you can take a peek there. And that's going to sell for around $60. Don't really quite know exactly when it's going to come out yet, but keep your eyes open for it. Matthew, let's take a break from news for a moment here and talk about our sponsor, Squarespace. Now, Squarespace is absolutely the best platform for creating a personal website, a blog, a portfolio, or an online store. I've been using Squarespace for 5 or 6 years now. I swear by this platform. And what I love about them is that they are constantly updating the platform with new features and new designs and even more support options. And they give you so many beautiful designs to start with, and it's incredibly easy for you to put together a website.
One of the neat things, Chris, of the way the website's designed as well is that it'll look great on any device. So you know how important it is to have your website, your blog, any of the things that you're doing online to look good, not only on somebody's computer where they might have a huge screen to be able to see the site, but also on an iPad or, say, an iPhone or an Android device. You really want that site to really pop when somebody sees it, even on their small iPhone screen. And so this is one of the things I really like about Squarespace as well, because you have a fantastic site on any device.
Absolutely. That's what they call responsive design. And I was just showing that to my wife, actually, yesterday, because I'm working on a site that's based on Squarespace. And we were working on the site in the browser, and she was seeing what it looks like on my large display. And then I pulled out my iPad and I pulled out my iPhone, and I opened it on all three of these devices at the same time. And she was amazed at how well the Squarespace system reflows the site, and especially how the menu system works on a smartphone, and how it breaks it down into a little menu link that you tap, and then you have access to the site's full menu, and it looks great. You know, it's none of that pinching and zooming stuff that you sometimes have to do on sites just to figure out, you know, how to navigate around. So that is fantastic. And the way that you build those sites is one of the true joys of using Squarespace. Using a system of blocks, you can actually assemble a page by just dragging different types of contents onto your page. And then Squarespace automatically locks those into a grid. And I use the word lock, but don't mistake that for being, you know, a rigid design and a very basic website. It just does the layout organization for you so that what you really think about is just the content and how you want to make your website look. There are fantastic controls behind the scenes that you have access to. You can modify the look and feel of your site, the widths, the typefaces, the sizes of your headers, and everything using sliders, just entering digits, sizes for the fonts. It's super easy. And it really takes all of the hard parts of building a website out of the picture and makes great web design accessible to really anyone.
Well, and I think this is one of the really nice things, Chris, is because Squarespace really cares about design. And all of the templates are extremely clean. And they really allow you to take that content that you've put on the site and have that be the focus and not necessarily the website itself. And for me, you know, I really don't like when I go to a website and it's just really cluttered. And Squarespace really understands this idea of design and how, you know, when you go to a certain type of website and it just pops out and everything is very easy to find, that's really what Squarespace helps you do. Take your content and make that the focus.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you care about design, if you want to make things easy on your readers, Squarespace is perfect starting point for that. And then, as I said, you can modify it and make it your own. You know, no two Squarespace sites look alike. And that's actually very true. And the other thing that they make really easy for you to do is to get that content out of your website to the world. You know, these days, it's really not enough to just put content on your website. It's great to have a website, but people aren't going to find it unless you let them know it's there. And so using Facebook, using Twitter, using Pinterest, Instagram, Google, there are so many ways these days to connect with everyone through social media. And Squarespace lets you connect your accounts with your site and automatically push your content out as you make a new post. You can take any page on your website and you can share it on your Facebook page. The connected accounts features of Squarespace are incredibly easy to use, and they make sure that all the time that you do put into creating content results in people coming to your site and reading your content, looking at your artwork, purchasing your products. It really makes your website the most effective tool, both for your personal branding or your business branding.
Well, and this is one of the nice things that they do as well, is that they give you this great calendar feature that enables you to have all of your events, and you can put those, especially if you have a small shop with live events and workshops. If you're a musician and you're on tour, you can share your schedule with others, with your fans. I think this is a really neat thing that Squarespace does, and allows it to be something that's simple and easy to use, and not overly complicated. And for me, I'm not a web savant, so there's nothing I hate worse than having to really spend hours trying to figure out these kind of things. And the Squarespace makes it simple and easy for anybody to be able to figure out and to use in just a few moments.
Yeah, the calendar is a really nice new feature. They've added quite a few new features just over the past month, and the calendar one is excellent. Other features they've added are the ability to duplicate pages in an easier way. You can restore deleted collections. So if you put your images into galleries and you build collections, you know, Squarespace has a great revisions tracking system, and they make it easy for you to restore things even if you have deleted them. And that's a great safety net. You know, I really appreciate those kinds of features because I don't have to use them very often. But, you know, we all make mistakes. We all change our minds sometimes. And it's great to be able to roll back when you need to. You can also send forms to multiple locations using the built-in form builder in Squarespace. And there are two new templates as well. There's Adirondack and Momentum. One is great for a store. One is great for a photo-centric blog. And those are added to the many wonderful templates that they already have there in Squarespace. And best of all, it doesn't cost you very much. The pricing is amazing. It's just $8 a month for the standard package, $16 a month for the unlimited package, and $24 per month for the business package, which gives you the incredible commerce features that tie into Stripe that can allow you to set up an online store and start processing credit cards and handle customer orders and shipping very easily in just a matter of minutes. And they'll even give you a free domain registration when you sign up for the annual or semi-annual plans. And we would love for you to try this out for free. Squarespace has a great offer for Trek FM listeners. You can get 10% off your purchase on new accounts. And you can try it free for 14 days, and you have access to all the features of Squarespace. And there's no credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com/trek. You just give them a name, an email address. They'll create a trial site for you. You can use all the features. You can import your existing site from WordPress, Blogger, or other platforms. See what it's like. And after 14 days, when you decide to sign up, and I know you will, you just enter offer code TREK5, and that will get you 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And choose the annual plan. Get that free domain registration. There's really no easier way to set up a website, a blog, a portfolio, an online store. It's all there for you at Squarespace. So give them a try. We know you'll love them. You'll be supporting our sponsor and helping us bring this programming to you every week. Okay, Matthew, we don't really have our normal movie news and rumors segment this week because, as I said at the beginning, the movie is now out. Many people have seen the movie. Everyone will be able to see it in a couple of days by the time this show drops. And except for those of us in Japan, of course, and Argentina, as we talked about last week. So we're kind of done with movie news and rumors at this point. One little bit of news here, though, is that Paramount has moved up the release date from the 17th to the 16th, citing strong interest in the film.
This is really exciting. I think that what they saw around the world was that people are responding to this film in droves. It's making more money than any Star Trek film has made overseas before. It's just tripling. I think I saw somewhere like tripled or something of Nemesis. You know, it just destroyed anything that Nemesis had done. And it's even destroying what the other JJ film had done box office wise. I think that they're just realizing that, you know, fans want the film now, and there's no reason, you know, the theaters are already set up to show the film on Wednesday. There's no reason not to open this up on Thursday and just let fans have a great time seeing it more times, because I'm going to see it on Wednesday. I'm also planning on seeing it on Friday because we have to talk about it on the Ready Room the next week. So I want to see it at least twice so I have a good sense of the film itself and not just that first reaction.
Yeah, I am hopeful that soon. I checked actually after seeing this story to see if the Japan date had been moved up, and it hasn't. But I am hopeful that as a result of this interest and as a result of the box office that the film is generating around the world, that they will move my release date up a bit as well. You know, they did already move it up 1 month because it was going to be the end of September. So I'm hoping that maybe, I don't know, maybe I can get it in late June, I hope, something like that. But it is exciting. I am glad to see that there is so much interest, and the international box office is huge because Star Trek films typically have not done so well internationally. I think that the casting that they did this time has helped a lot. I think casting Benedict Cumberbatch as the villain was big because, of course, he's huge in the UK, but I think he's big everywhere. You know, Sherlock, the BBC Sherlock, is kind of becoming a thing here in Japan as well. And so I think this cast has really grabbed the interest of audiences worldwide.
Yeah, I think this speaks to the fact that fans of the first movie are responding to the second movie in this JJ universe. But also, I think fans that were created just by seeing it on like maybe Netflix or DVD around the world are responding to it now by going to see the second film. And it just goes to show that this movie and this universe that JJ's created are really reaching people in a way that's not just, oh, it's just another blockbuster. I think it's speaking to the strength of JJ's work here.
Yeah, I agree. So they say that tickets are available in the app, the Star Trek app that they released for iPhone. And also, you can go to IMAX.com, or you can go to Fandango.com or MovieTickets.com and other ticketing platforms. Or just go to your box office at the theater, and you'll be able to get tickets in all those places while supplies last. And all the 8 p.m. IMAX fans are going to receive a limited edition IMAX Fanfix Star Trek Gallery 1988 movie print by Mark Englert. Now, I don't know exactly what that is, but it sounds like something that will at some point in the future be a collectible for those attending. So always nice to get those nice things. Now, I was going to ask you, Matthew, in Japan, when we have movies, we have programs. You have to buy them, and they're usually like, I don't know, $6 or $8 or $10 for a program. But we have these very large, like almost tabloid size programs printed on art paper, very heavy, glossy art paper. They have lots of beautiful imagery in from the films. They have lots of background information about the actors in the film. And I noticed that at least at the London showing, which we're going to talk about in a moment, they had that as well. Do American theaters have anything like that?
You know, we don't have programs like that at all. And, you know, that's just not something that happens with the American cinemas. And so it's disappointing. I think it would be something that would be fun. I mean, obviously, you know, if you did this for Star Trek, gosh, fans would just eat that up. You know, we love to collect things. And so
yeah.
I'm really excited, though, that they're doing this for the IMAX showings. I'll be getting one. My theater, I'm going to see it in IMAX on Wednesday. My brother-in-law and sister will be with me. So, if they don't want theirs, I've already kind of promised them to other people already that aren't getting them in IMAX. So, yeah. Or to the highest bidder, you know, who knows? maybe I'll just eBay them. I am really excited. This is really cool. And it will be a great memory for me to have this of going to see it early. And what a great reward, too. I mean, you know, when you signed up on the app, you had no idea that we were going to be getting a reward for doing that. And going to see it in IMAX 3D, they're giving the fans a nice reward for signing up early. And I think what a great way to say thank you to the fans by giving them something great they could put on their wall.
What they don't mention is that attendees to the midnight showing will each get a personal psychoanalysis by John Harrison.
I was just hoping for, you know, 5 minutes with Alice Eve.
That's only available to a select few, I believe.
Kirk.
Well, speaking of the London showing, our own Mike Schindler from Commentary Trek Stars was there, along with Colin. I've got a great photo of him with Colin as well. And he was there for the midnight showing at the Odeon in London. And Mike recorded a short report for us from the location. And so we're going to share that with you now.
Hello, this is Mike from Commentary Trek Stars. One of the few things I'm more nerdy about than Star Trek is movie theaters. I know, it's weird. So when the opportunity arose to see Star Trek Into Darkness at the best possible venue in the world, I had to take it. This story actually starts a few months ago when it was decided to take a family trip to Paris. Don't get me wrong, Paris is great and all, but it kind of bummed me out that I would not be around for the IMAX fan screenings here in the States. Then it was announced that the film would open a week early in the UK. It took me all of about 2 seconds to come to the realization that on May 9th, I would be a short train ride away from London's BFI IMAX Theatre, one of the largest screens in the world. Let's put it this way. There was no way in hell I was going to travel 4,200 miles across the world and then stop 200 miles short of this theatre. So, last Tuesday morning, my wife, my sister, and I packed our bags and hopped on the Eurail to London. We saw the sights and whatnot, basically killing time until Wednesday night's midnight opening of the film. The morning of the show, Colin came down to the city to hang out with us. It was pretty cool to be able to spend Star Trek Day hanging out with another member of the Trek FM family. Finally, the time came to head over to the theater. Even though our seats were reserved and we had picked up our tickets the night before, I still wanted to get there about 45 minutes early just to soak up the atmosphere. We weren't the first to arrive. I don't know why, but I was surprised by how many people were in costume. Everyone was quite excited to get their first glimpse of fresh Trek in 4 years. People forget that this has been the longest gap between Trek installments since the debut of the motion picture back in 1979. Even the gap between Enterprise and Star Trek '09 was a few weeks shorter than this gap. The theater did its part to enhance the atmosphere as well. Large character banners were on display. Even the menu boards behind the concession stand had pictures from the movie. Once we entered the auditorium, I finally saw with my own eyes the reason why the BFI IMAX was chosen for the London premiere of the film. The beautiful 480-seat auditorium has a massive 85-foot wide screen and a 6-channel 12,000-watt surround sound system. The presentation was all I had hoped for. Abrams had shot nearly a quarter of the movie in IMAX, and the gorgeous 15-perf 70mm print took full advantage of what the negative had to offer. If you have the opportunity to see the film in the true IMAX format, take it. The 3D looked very good as well, one of the best post-conversions I've ever seen. As for the movie itself, it's quite good. Abrams and company do an excellent job of building on the first film. They riff on the Prime Universe canon in such a way as to support the themes they wish to tackle without feeling tied down to what has come before. It's not as good as the last movie, but still excellent in its own right. On the way out of the screening, the BFI had one last surprise for us. Everyone who attended received a glow-in-the-dark poster commemorating the midnight IMAX release. I feel very fortunate to have been able to attend the first public screening of Star Trek Into Darkness at such an amazing venue. It was a night I'll always remember fondly. This is Mike from Commentary Trek Stars signing off.
It was really cool, Chris, of Mike to just kind of share with us what his experience was in London about Into Darkness. And so just makes me all the more excited to see this film. Man, what a great place to be able to go see it. You know, I know he was hanging out with Colin as well. And so really wish I could have been there with the guys, gone to see the movie and then grabbed a pint.
That would have been awesome indeed. All right, so that's it for the movie itself. We have one last thing to talk about in news this week. And, you know, we're taking a break from Literary Treks because Matthew is going to see the premiere in the U.S. of Star Trek Into Darkness, and we won't be able to record. We thought we would look at IDW's Star Trek Ongoing number 20 here on the Ready Room this week. Very briefly, we're not going to give away the story, so no big spoilers, but this is the last ongoing comic prior to the film. So when we get 21, it will be the first issue of the After Darkness series that is going to be the official sequel to the film. Now, Ongoing number 20 is the last of our character introductions as well. And this one combines Chekhov and Sulu and tells us how they first met.
Yeah, this is actually really fun, Chris. It has some great references to other series that we've seen, specifically Deep Space Nine. And it also gives us a great picture of who these two men are what they've been through. And I really enjoyed just some of the surprises that came along in this story. I think this is when, you know, we look at the backstories that they've given us. I really enjoy this backstory. I feel like we've got some great things in here that really give us more character development for these two.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's it is a shorter comic. It's 22 pages. And that combines the story of two different characters. But the way that they bring the two stories together in the end makes it work in the short space. And like you said, I did like the references to DS9 and also a few to the first movie as well. We do get to see Gala, which is always nice. And I like the scenery as well. The look around the San Francisco area is quite nice. It's something that we haven't really seen in the comics or in Star Trek in general, actually, and it kind of makes it all feel a little bit more real to me that Starfleet headquarters is there in San Francisco, as I am familiar with the area. And but the story tells us a lot. It gives us that background, especially about Sulu and his ambition to be captain, you know, which we do see as he finally becomes captain of the Excelsior prior to the Undiscovered Country.
Well, and also I like that, you know, Sulu says that he replaced Ensign McKenna on the Enterprise and why he replaced her. And I think that was a fun to get to see actually who this ensign is. It was actually a great backstory for that. And it just adds more now to that scene when it happens when you're watching 2009.
And what I also found interesting in here from an artwork standpoint was the scene of the ships flying over the Starfleet Academy grounds, just because it reminds me so much of that scene in the Into Darkness trailer where the cadets are out there on the grounds and the ships are flying over in the formation. And I would assume, of course, on the timeline that those must be separate events here, because obviously this is taking place on Federation Day, a Federation Day celebration. And at this point, Chekov and Sulu are still cadets. And in Into Darkness, of course, they're members of the Enterprise crew. But it's a nice little connection there that helps me feel that, you know, this is all taking place in the same universe within a few years of each story.
Well, and Chris, did we mention, I don't know, I just want to go back. Did we mention that Gayla is in this? Because I think you might have, but I just think she's worth mentioning twice. Anytime that there's an Orion, an Orion woman, you should probably mention her more than once, because she looks fantastic.
Yeah, I think that's why your iPad is frozen on page 10, isn't it?
It is. And actually, I might just have screenshotted that, blew it up a little bit, and it's the, you know, when I open my iPad, that's the picture I get.
Maybe so. So, we don't want to give away, you know, the whole story of what happens in here, but it's a fun read, and it wraps up the character studies that we've been getting, character background studies that we've been getting in ongoing. And we know that the next four issues are going to be the official sequel to the movie, After Darkness. And then, Matthew, I guess that moving forward in this series, I don't think we're going to be getting any more retellings of original series episodes, do you? I mean, they haven't said that, but I just kind of feel like that was kind of to introduce and ease us into things. And now it feels like they're going to kind of run on their own now. What do you think?
I think after Into Darkness, and they're going to do After Darkness, which is the kind of the follow-up series for the comics, I really do feel like they're going to be charting a whole new territory. They're not really going to be looking to what they did at the very beginning of the comic series. Also, too, you know, Countdown to Darkness had a lot of things that I think are going to get followed up in. Are going to get followed up with the comics. I think we're going to see the character of Mud again. And those kind of things, I think those are going to come back into play. They've really created a whole mythos now in their universe that they can play with without having to reach back to the original series and doing that stuff. I mean, we're still going to get great homages to the series. You're just not going to have a direct one-for-one like they did with, say, Where No Man Has Gone Before or Operation Annihilate!
I like the exclamation mark there.
I know you do, Chris. I did it just for you.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, I think they are going to be charting their own territory from now on, and we can only hope that we see more of Mud. In the same year the Enterprise went black, marking the end of Star Trek on television, Paramount reached out to a new creative team for ideas on how to revive the franchise. Yes, revive the franchise that was just on television a few months earlier. Nevertheless, what came next was the revelation that J.J. Abrams was developing a new Star Trek film, and slowly we learned that this was going to be a reboot of the franchise, and they were going to recast Kirk and Spock and pretty much start all over. And we all know what happened next. It started a debate within the fandom that continues to this day. So as we get set for the premiere of Star Trek Into Darkness, we are at last on the Ready Room going to tackle Star Trek 2009. And to help us do that, we have with us our managing editor, Mistress Charlene Schmidt. Hello, Char.
Hello, hello.
And we have with us from Commentary Trek Stars, Max Hegel. Hey, Max.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Good to be on. All right. Good to have you. So, we're going to talk about Star Trek 2009. Now, anyone who listens to the Ready Room regularly knows that we love to playfully refer to this film as Space Adventure 2009, which actually started on Dork Trek, and a friend of the show, Ben McCormick, loves to call it Space Adventure 2009. Now, I do it in a joking manner. Personally, I have mixed feelings about this film, and I think it's a movie that you can look at in two ways. You can look at it as a movie, and you can look at it as a Star Trek movie. And depending on which way you look at it, you get different things from this film. So we're going to look at both the strengths and the weaknesses of the film today. And Matthew, I'm going to ask you to start us off, because I know that you find a lot of Star Trek in this film, and I want to start us off on a positive note. So why don't you lead us into the discussion?
Oh, goodness, Chris, where to start? I will say, just, you know, my experience with this film was, I saw it with a friend for the first time when it opened, and I was living in Minnesota at the time. It was freezing and still snowy. So Charlene knows exactly what I'm talking about. We went and saw the film. It was a Friday night, and we immediately went and bought tickets to see it again, sat in a bar, had a few drinks, and went and saw it again because we enjoyed it so much. So for me, that was just kind of my first reaction to the film. I really enjoyed it. I think, you know, I was very trepidatious. I'm a huge fan. I was worried that they were going to completely screw this up. It was going to be terrible, worst thing ever. And so I went in with really low expectations, and so I came out really surprised. I think that this movie has a clear message. I know a lot of fans, they really have hated this movie because they don't see any Star Trek in it. But this idea reverberates, I think, with the best of Star Trek, and the idea that you're going to be on a mission to serve something greater than yourself. I love the scene where Pike, you know, he comes in, Kirk has got his bloody ass on the table, tells him he can whistle really loud, and he gets challenged by somebody to do something different with his life, and to be something better. And then he tells him that, you know, Starfleet's important. It's a humanitarian and peacekeeping armada. And it really reminded me and closely mirrored what Picard says to Lily when he tells her that, you know, the acquisition of wealth is no longer the driving force in our lives. We work to better ourselves and the rest of humanity. And that, you know, that is what Pike is trying to get across to Kirk. You can live a normal, mundane life, or you can do something better. You can be something better. And, you know, so these men and women who join Starfleet, they're being called out on a mission and a purpose that transcends themselves for the betterment of humanity. And that is definitely, from the very beginning of Star Trek, at the heart of it, what it means to boldly go where no one has gone before. And so for me, this movie speaks these messages, especially this one, I think, very strongly. But it's also different than your father's Star Trek. It's not going to just preach the message at you, like, big time. You know, you're not going to get Picard, who's going to preach, you know, at you, basically. You're not going to get Kirk doing any moralizing. You're not going to get any ready rooms or, you know, observation lounges. It's going to be a quick, fast-paced film, modern sensibility. But they are going to weave these messages inside the action. But you have to be paying attention. You know, you have to be watching the movie critically. You can just watch it for all the fun, for all the action, and this movie does that really well. But I think, clearly, this movie has an awesome message of saying, look, you can do something better. And being involved in something that's greater than yourself is really what's going to give you a purpose and a mission to be on in life. because otherwise you're just living for yourself. And, you know, we see the road that Kirk could go down. You know, he definitely can choose to just be, you know, a genius repeat level offender for the rest of his life.
Maybe he'll love it.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe he'll love it. But for me, I think that's something that's huge in this film and that I really, really enjoy about it. I think it really comes out well. You just have to be looking for it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Matt, actually, because you could take this movie, enjoy it for what it is, but if you're not actually looking for deeper embedded messages, you're going to totally miss it. And I think a lot of fans do that. And they say, well, this isn't really Star Trek. But it is there. You have to find it, though. You know what I mean? It's not going to hit you in the face. Like you said, it's not a speech. It's not going to be a lecture. It's much more subtle. But it's still there. I think one of the biggest things is the impact of a father, or maybe a lack thereof, especially for Kirk, and how his life was so different without his father in his life.
Well, and you end up, Char, with that, and I'm glad you brought that up, because you end up with this thing that you see in our society today, the lack of fathers. And so Kirk is a man who doesn't have one. His father's been taken away from him. But in a lot of our world, fathers just leave their kids. And their sons specifically have a really hard time dealing with somebody teaching them what it means to be a man. And without the intervention of Pike in Kirk's life, he's going to go on being this kind of man boy, you know, chasing women, getting in trouble, because he doesn't have a sense that there's a greater purpose in life. And then Spock, on the other side, is facing the same exact thing that boys do today with just emotionally distant fathers. You know, we've just transferred a whole culture of emotionally distant fathers. And, you know, Spock's life, he's completely conflicted the whole time. He doesn't know which way to go. And really, it takes the death of his mother for his father to finally open up to him. And it's that scene where his father says, I loved her. And the scene, I think, at the end where he meets Prime Spock and he realizes that he can embrace his nature and move forward. And I just, this is another great message in this movie about this idea of what fatherhood really means and how important it is specifically to boys to have somebody show them what it means to be a real man, not just some kind of man boy who's lost in adolescence. And, you know, again, what a huge, great message. I mean, what a great message to show to your son, you know, to talk to about with your son or your nephew or somebody like that, just, and the importance of men being there for their children, or for, you know, maybe, you know, you don't have any children, but being there for a boy who doesn't have a father. And giving them
big brothers, big sisters.
Exactly. Exactly.
Be a mentor.
It's a fantastic message in this film. And unless you're paying attention, you are going to miss it, because this movie is flashing a lot of things at you. And I'm not just talking about lens flare.
Let's talk about that for a minute. The reboot itself. One thing, and actually, all that stuff is in there, and I get all that stuff too, and I agree with you that that is part of what Star Trek is. And I've said many times, for me, Star Trek is about exploring the human condition. You know, it's a way for us to look at societal issues and discuss them in ways, as all science fiction is, that we can't necessarily do if we just say things out in the open. We can talk about topics that are sometimes too sensitive to just talk about without wrapping them in space clothing. But again, that's a trait of science fiction in general, not just Star Trek. And the other day, Rick Berman actually tweeted that, you know, Star Trek is designed, Gene Roddenberry designed Star Trek to be on television, to tell short, character-driven stories. And I think what the question for me is with a lot of this is, with it being a reboot and the fact that we get 2 hours of story every 4 years right now, how far into this exploration of ourselves can we go? And Max, I know that you're kind of on the other side, at least as far as whether it's Star Trek or not Star Trek, but talking about it being a reboot. Now, I mean, I grew up with TOS, so for me, it was difficult to picture anyone in the role of Kirk or Spock or Uhura or anyone else. But I think I'm okay with it, actually, you know, the way they play the roles. But as Star Trek itself is a reboot, how do you feel about this film?
Well, it's sort of complicated. I'm much more of an original series fanatic than I am anything else, and so seeing, you know, Kirk and Spock and McCoy, that was a pretty exciting prospect. And my disappointment with the movie is not has nothing to do with them not living up to the characters. It's more not challenging the present. And Star Trek was a product of the 60s, and it was revolutionary, and a lot of its stories were not about individuals, but about political and social problems. And a lot of the solutions presented in the show were controversial. They were things that many people who could theoretically be watching the show would disagree with profoundly. And the new movie doesn't seem to have the guts to say anything that people might disagree with. And I think that saying something that people might disagree with seems rather fundamental to Star Trek as a thing. So the loss of that, I think, is rather significant. So I am disappointed by it, in large.
Do you think that the fact that, because I agree with you there, the fact that it's a movie and not a television series plays into that?
Totally.
They want to reboot Star Trek. They want to get the general audience interested in it. And so they essentially, to me, put out an action movie. And like Matthew pointed out, there are really good messages and there are some great conversations in there. And if you watch for them, you can pull them out and you can take some things away from the film. And they are related to characters that we've known and that we've grown up with. But I feel like they have to couch them in all the action so much because their ultimate goal here is simply to bring in a new general audience and get them into the theater. And if this were on television, they could do that. Plus, they could go deeper into exploring those issues and talk about controversial topics and solutions, as you mentioned, Max, much more easily.
Even that, there's an argument because even on TV, controversy is kind of a death sentence for a lot of series.
Challenging. But Star Trek, I don't know.
But I mean, it's all about money. It's how much money they pour into it.
But Star Trek doesn't have to be about controversial issues to be Star Trek. I think that the issue that we talked about fathers and sons, is a huge issue, and nobody wants to talk about it because it's something that then goes into talking about people having children out of wedlock and people being responsible and all of those kind of things. That those are touchy issues. I'm sorry, but you start bringing that up and people are going to start, you know, getting on you for being a moralizing bastard. But it's an important issue, you know, and this gives you a chance to talk about it. So I think, honestly, for a first movie trying to reintroduce the series to a general audience, and yes, you do want to do that because otherwise it just dies, I think it brings up some great issues. It gives us a great place to start. And then hopefully, you know, we all, I'm sure, hope that Into Darkness will take it further and do that, you know, take it a step further. And we don't know yet. We haven't seen the film. We're here in the States. And so, and Chris is in Japan, and they don't get it till, you know, like next year.
I won't see it until the end of August.
Yeah.
Star Trek into August.
Star Trek into August, yes! So I think that just because it might not necessarily beat us over the head with something controversial doesn't make this not Star Trek.
I don't think it's a question of beating us over the head, though. I think that, you know, you can say it's a starting point, but it's hard to start something that you're going to continue 4 years later, and then you're going to do a third installment 4 years later, and then it's going to be done, and that's it.
I don't quite understand why people say it's not Star Trek. I don't agree with that. I just think that it's not the best of Star Trek.
Now that I would agree with. I wouldn't say it's Star Trek at its absolute finest. It is Star Trek, and it's not horrible Star Trek. For me, it lies in the middle. I'll just say that.
And yeah, I'm probably in the middle. I think for me, it's that I'm a big fan of science fiction literature and of course science fiction films. And when I watch the movie, I feel like I could largely strip the Star Trek uniforms and such out of this movie, and mm-hmm. I could tell the same story. And part of that is the fact that we're going back to the very, very beginning. So in this film, you don't have the whole history of TOS, TNG, DS9, and everything to look to fall back upon. You're at the beginning of a story. And so the story happens to be about Kirk and Spock and Starfleet, but it could easily not be. It could easily be someone else who lost their father in a space battle.
And does Spock need to be an alien? I don't see the merit of the Vulcan race in the movie.
Well, I mean, I do. I think it gives you an opportunity. You know, the most enlightened race, and I say that in air quotes, is also the one that it really shows the most bigotry in the film. And I think that's really interesting. You know, the children, they make fun of young Spock because his father is a traitor. He married that, you know, human whore. And then, of course, he's standing before the council, the Vulcan Science Academy, and they tell him that he's had a disadvantage, his human mother. I mean, I'm not really sure if there's a better insult at that point than live long and prosper. I mean, so I think that that's another thing to be able to talk about, is that just because you're some kind of quote-unquote enlightened race, you have this idea of logic as your basis, doesn't necessarily mean that you've moved past things like bigotry and racism. I mean, just blatant racism. Yeah. It might be hidden behind a cloak. And so, you know, and that's what Enterprise did really well, was show that the you know, Vulcans had lost their way from this.
Yeah, I was going to say these Vulcans are more like the Enterprise Vulcans than they are the Vulcans right. in the prime.
And this show, this movie in general, feels a lot closer to the in-between Enterprise and TOS. And we have to remember, Bones is a bigot in the original series. I mean, he is constantly berating Spock. He loves Spock, but he also thinks Spock is, you know, a green-blooded hobgoblin, you know? And he really believes that, you know, that the Vulcan way of life isn't as good as the human way of life. And so that kind of, and Spock on the other side believes that about McCoy and Kirk. I mean, and so we forget, I think, that these characters in TOS were, you know, they're not the perfect characters. There's a lot of bigotry and there's a lot of those things that happen between the characters. And it's not just because it's a 60s show. At that point, they're, you know, that was just how the characters interacted with each other. And so this movie with the Vulcans and the humans and Spock is allowing us to talk about that again, because we're still having these issues today. And apparently in the 23rd century, they're probably still going to exist.
Who knew that bigotry and bullying was logical? If we want to talk about current events and issues, bullying is freaking huge. This should definitely get the gears cranking on people's heads.
It's really huge here in Japan. I mean, we have a problem right now of kids committing suicide in middle school.
Yeah, I don't think it's logical. I didn't accept the bullying in the movie. I thought that it was kind of silly that the Vulcan children would even care.
Well, I think it was very cliched. It was very like, this is how kids act to each other in school, and it is. But I will say that I think it's a good topic to bring up, and I think it is one that's an issue in society today. I do think in the film, it comes off to me as being there purely to set Spock on his course to go to Starfleet Academy. Yeah. And it's really quick. And if you listen, thank God, J.J. Abrams, I think he's a great filmmaker, but thank God he has some people in the editing room and some other people, the staff, because if you listen to the commentary to this film, Some of the timing and the dialogue changes that were made in this film were things that were suggested by people just on staff. And they're so much better than what was originally written. The way that that scene with the bullying was originally written would have really come off as like, okay, yeah, this is really cliche. It's really cheesy. And it's purely there to serve to push Spock away from Vulcan. The way that it was edited and rewritten, it comes off a bit better.
I feel that sort of like editing it down from possibly being controversial to someone to being controversial to almost no one, which is a little depressing. Yeah.
Well, while we're talking about Spock, let's go ahead and talk about emotional Spock a little bit, because I personally don't have a problem with Spock being more emotional, because I think that it does allow more room in storytelling than what we get with Vulcans normally. You know, Spock himself in TOS, and especially in the films, I thought was quite good. The Vulcans became, like, by the time we got to Tuvok, the Vulcans became such a completely uninteresting race in Star Trek that they were just completely cardboard cutout. And T'Pol was even that way, you know, in the beginning of Enterprise as well. But in this movie, Spock, from the very beginning, from being a child all the way through, when we see him facing the committee, being accepted into the Vulcan Science Academy, when he talks to his father, when he talks to his mother, he's very much a more emotional being than Leonard Nimoy's Spock ever was in the original series. How do you guys feel about emotional Spock, or Shar, as you called him in the other side of the room?
The other side of the room.
Emo Spock.
Yes, I did. I feel like this is a nice little culmination, actually, of what we have learned on how to characterize, act, and write Vulcans. We don't want them overly stiff and stoic, like Tuvok, because that's boring. We did have Spock Prime evolve. He was much more Vulcan in the beginning, and then he starts to learn to listen to his human half a little more as he gets older, whereas this Spock is more raw.
And then it gets taken away from him, and then he has to start over again, and then he finds his way back, to the point where I love the scene with him and Valeris in the Undiscovered Country in his quarters, because that's where I feel like this is where Spock has reached the end of his journey, and he's figured out how to balance
his two logic sides. Is the beginning
and
of
he
wisdom,
didn't even
not
need
the
Harrison
end.
To help him figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, he has definitely come full circle by The Undiscovered Country. He's a very balanced Spock. This guy in this movie is extraordinarily raw. He wants to control his emotions so hard, and they are just boiling underneath all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I like that in this movie, again, you get that picture when Spock is with his dad, and he really wants to be able to live up to his father in this Vulcan way of life. And yet, he has such a hard time doing it because his human emotions and his Vulcan emotions mixed together are like the perfect storm. You know, Vulcans might have more severe emotions than humans, but putting that non-Vulcan control or lack of that inside of him makes it much more difficult. And, you know, I think, again, that's a great picture of how many kids, you know, they want to live up to their parents and they have no idea how to do that. And for Spock, this creates a problem. And then, of course, you know, he has that unconditional love from his mother. And I think that calms him. And then, of course, she's taken away. And, you know, he gets to that point where he's just so angry, he wants to murder someone. And he doesn't know what to do with that either. And he can't talk to it about the only person who understands emotions that he trusts, which is Amanda. And I think that's what leads to a beautiful scene between him and Sarek, where he says, I think she would tell you not to try to control it. And then he talks about how he actually has emotions and he has experienced them in the love he had for Amanda, giving Spock, I think, finally the okay to be not the perfect Vulcan, but to just be who he is. And hopefully, at least in the next film, we'll see maybe a little bit of that evolution of who that Spock is going to be. Maybe a little more centered and a little bit more sure of himself and okay with himself. You know, you're right. You only get 2 hours to do with these characters, but at least from the story I get here, I feel like you get a nice progression of Spock kind of growing, and there's a good arc in this movie for him.
And we have seen in the comics following this movie that one of the results of the death of his mother on Spock and the destruction of Vulcan is that this Spock has become a much more reckless character and a much a risk taker compared to Leonard Nimoy's Spock. And he actually does a lot of the things that we would normally expect from Kirk, but in this universe, we're getting them from Spock instead.
Which makes for, I mean, again, this is why you respect the canon before, but you set yourself apart so that you can create a new story where you don't know automatically what's going to happen. And that's, for me, the fun of the JJ universe in general is just, I don't know what's going to happen with these characters. They're kind of the same, and I still love them, but I don't know what's going to happen to them. And it's a lot of fun trying to figure that out.
Yeah, it's a different playground, that's for sure.
While we're on Spock again, quick question. This is not its own topic. I just have to ask you because it's one of the things that has gotten everyone so up in arms about. Spock and Uhura. How do you feel about Spock and Uhura?
Okay, you know, when I first saw that, I was a little weirded out. Like, where the hell did that come from? But
did it weird you out as much as Scotty and Uhura in Star Trek V?
No, that was way weirder. Way weirder. I will take Spock and Uhura any day. Now that I've seen the movie a few thousand times, I'm totally okay with it.
It was a shock, you know, when you saw that. But at the same time, if you watch TOS closely, there are some episodes where you see a flirtation between Spock and Uhura. And so it's not completely out of the blue. I feel like they just took some cues from the original series that happened in a couple episodes, and they just ramped that up. And that's fine. I mean, there's, you know, again, you're in a different universe, and so you can do different things. And two, I mean, I don't think this is all that it is, and I hope that isn't in the new film, but it does give Uhura as well something else to do, because she almost have never anything to do in the TOS, and at least now she has something else to do.
She needs to do even more than be lover girl in this next movie. Because I'm sorry, that's a very cliche role for a girl.
Right. I think in this next movie, she will have a big role. I mean, everything that we've seen shows that the trifecta in Into Darkness is Kirk, Spock, and Uhura, not Kirk, Spock, and Bones. But in this movie we're talking about today, in 2009, I have no problem at all with the relationship. There are those moments in TOS early in the first season where there is this flirtation between Spock and Uhura. I think a lot of fans who were up in arms about it either didn't notice those things or they have chosen to selectively forget that those happened in order to justify being outraged by it. But it doesn't bother me at all if the two characters want to be together. What I didn't like about it was that so much of Uhura's role in this movie is running around to check on Spock
and hugging him and kissing him.
And I want to see Uhura do something more to contribute to the crew than just to check on Spock all the time.
To her credit, though, at least this Uhura stuck up for herself when she realized she wasn't assigned to the Enterprise and said, look, no, I have earned this. You can't take this away from me just because of our relationship. My own merit gets me in. I'm there.
Well, she pointed out to him that on many occasions, she has shown extreme oral sensitivity.
Indeed.
That's the actual line in the film.
I think he's experienced that oral sensitivity.
Many times.
Yeah. But
yes.
So Max, you haven't chimed in on the relationship yet.
Well, I don't have like the outrage of some fans. I'm not like outraged by the idea of a Kirk, of like a Spock or a romance. I'm not outraged by Vulcans having romances or any of that. I'm more disappointed that we can't have a logical, unemotional Vulcan as a member of the crew. It seems kind of strange that in order to make Spock relatable, we have to give him emotions. I never thought that that was necessary.
But Spock's always been like that from the very beginning. I mean, Nimoy might play him. What we consider maybe next to Shatner is unemotional, but Spock is always portraying emotion.
It's true. So. But the ideal of being unemotional, the ideal of living a life of logic, I think that that's a virtuous thing. And I think that recognizing the virtue of logic is interesting. And I think that recognizing that Spock and Bones and Kirk kind of form one whole person and each individually isn't really complete makes sense. And I find it disappointing that we can't have that anymore. That's just too complicated for a modern audience.
So you don't think that that trifecta is there with this new cast? You don't think that there's id, superego, and ego at play here as there is in the original series? You don't think Spock can still be that logical balance?
No, not even a little bit. I think that there was a desperation to make all of the characters likable. And when you try to make all the characters likable, especially a person who sort of defines emotionally unavailable, there's something respectable about treating that seriously and demanding that you appreciate him because he has a point. And there's something sad about changing him and making him and his father essentially kind of just phonies in order to satisfy an audience.
But Spock in the Undiscovered Country tells Valeris that logic is only the beginning of wisdom. And therefore, Spock was realized that it's not just logic that drives a person or that can be lived by, because logic can be used to make anything happen. You know, logic has to be tempered with a lot of other things, and that's what Spock from the Undiscovered Country has learned, especially by being around Kirk and McCoy. You know, this Spock in this universe is a lot younger than we've seen him in the original series. So that plays in. And two...
I'm not arguing that it's incorrect. I'm not arguing that, like, this depiction of Spock is wrong. I'm arguing that this depiction, this series of events, this choice to do this story featuring these characters going through these events, seeing their actions in this context, it's disappointing how easy a lot of the decisions were, how simple a lot of the interactions are when considering the alternate possibilities. They were all sort of the safest choice. And that's what I object to, not it being incorrect. Because, I mean, it's true, Spock absolutely had emotions, and there's no reason why he didn't have relationships. But to have all of these things put so prominently in the narrative, that seems pathetic.
Well, but I completely disagree, because otherwise you're just going to get a retread of what's already been done, and the point is to do something different with these characters. Otherwise, there's no reason to go back and do this all in the first place. So either... And I don't have a problem with that, because they're telling me a different story with the same characters, and that's okay, because
I agree, it's
giving me a new view on these characters. It's almost as if this is kind of like a mirror universe or the Prime universe without being everybody's evil. It's just it's a different skew, and that's makes it interesting.
It's a different mirror universe.
It's an alternate timeline.
There's like three parallel universes. One is the Prime universe. One is the everyone's kind of amoral, and the other one is everyone's extremely relatable to a mass audience. And that's disappointing.
There's your trifecta right there, Max.
Well, that's a good point too, because this is another thing that is, you know, all you have to do is watch Twitter to see how ridiculously outraged a lot of Star Trek fans are about the J.J. Abrams take on Star Trek. And I really think that, and they address this in the movie directly, Spock says it to the crew. Spock says that Nero's very presence has changed the timeline whatever our lives would have been before, our paths have changed now. So it's written into the movie that from the moment that Nero appears, everything's changed. This is a branching off. It's an alternate universe. So really anything can happen in this universe. And as the fan, I feel, and this is why I'm personally not up in arms about the Abrams verse, because for me, there's Star Trek, and then there is this Abrams verse, and it's fine with me. They can do whatever they want to do creatively. It doesn't impact my 47 years of Star Trek that came before that. But I think of a lot of fans missed that line in the movie because a lot of people don't seem to understand or at least be willing to accept that this is another timeline. It's an alternate history that's taking place at this point moving forward. And that leads me, while we're talking about Spock and what affects him, to another topic I wanted to talk about, which is the destruction of Vulcan, because more so than Spock and Uhura, I have seen extreme anger from people about the destruction of Vulcan. Like, it's just blasphemy that you would destroy Vulcan in this film. But as a creative myself, I think that it's an excellent creative choice in story writing, because if you want to do something different, if you want to set this universe on its own course, destroying one of the key planets of the Federation, which throws one of your main characters into turmoil emotionally, who's not even supposed to be emotional, I mean, that's a great way to really shake things
up.
And Vulcan still exists in our prime timeline. You know, they didn't destroy Vulcan completely. They destroyed Vulcan in this alternate timeline. I personally have no problem with that.
Well, and it really, I think, too, it sets Nero apart as a villain. I mean, this guy's willing to destroy whole freaking planets. And, you know, Nero...
Which is a lot like what Shinzon wanted to do.
Right.
And Sorin.
You know, Nero isn't the best Star Trek villain, but the fact that he's willing to destroy whole planets and actually does do that, you know, is really scary. And it does set this apart by saying, look, this is, again, this is not your daddy's Star Trek. We are going to do something different, and we are going to take away a planet that you're used to. But again, you know, it doesn't take away Vulcan in the Prime universe, so I'm fine with it, because it makes for a great creative choice, and it really ramps up how bad this villain is, and it makes me fearful for what else could happen in this film. When you're watching it the first time, you're thinking, oh my god, they just destroyed Vulcan. What other planet is he going to destroy? And then he goes and attacks Earth. I mean, so, you know, all of these things, you don't know what's going to happen. It makes for a very tense film, and somebody who is extremely evil, you know. And I think, for all of his weaknesses, Nero is a capable villain, and he's really willing to go all out and not pull any punches. And that's scary.
Yeah, he is definitely a dangerous villain, but I feel like his backstory in the film itself is very thin. You have to go read the comics to really understand his true motivations. Without that, I just feel like he is a very... Yeah. Two-dimensional character with very little substance to him. He's just a bad guy.
Spock was late.
Although so this time I
is filled with rage.
Yeah,
for the
someone
rest of his
to
life.
Blow up planets. Yeah. I'm angry. Arr!
Spock was late.
Sorry, that's a Klingon.
Yeah, if you're going out to lunch with Dero, you better show up on time.
No,
or he
kidding.
Will blow up your planet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, stupid mother effing Spock. Was late. That's it. His car is gone.
Fire everything.
I think something I caught this time was the fact that Nero's plan, he realizes he's in an alternate timeline. So he's going to create a Romulus in this timeline that's free of the Federation and anybody else who would get in the way of Romulus. And then he also has the red matter he needs now to be able to stop anything that, you know, supernova wise that comes in the future. So I hadn't really caught all of that before, but it did help fill in for me just how crazy this guy is. And you know, he's been driven mad by his anger in a little bit the same way that Khan was driven mad and with his anger by the end of the Wrath of Khan.
In a lot the same way.
There's some nice, yeah. But I like it. I mean, again, you're going to have parallels between the universes a little bit. And I think the more I watch the film, the more I find Nero a scarier villain and better written than I thought. So
that's weird.
Yeah. I think Eric Bana's performance was very good, I thought. But as a villain, yeah, he's, for me, he's very kind of vanilla and he has his rage, but there he goes. But you know what helped me most though to understand, you know, how that all works was it was the Scientific American article that I read in 2007 about how you could use red matter to stop supernovae and prevent the destruction of planets. Because that red matter, knowing the scientific basis of it, it made it a lot easier for me to understand.
You read this in the Mirror Universe, didn't you?
Oh, goodness.
Their stellar sciences are way beyond ours.
We can talk about red matter for just a minute in the sense that a lot of, I don't know, Max, you said earlier that a lot of the decisions that were made in the film were kind of the easiest or the most obvious decisions that they could make. You know, there wasn't a lot of challenging there. And the red matter bit for me was like, I can get past red matter as a science fiction reader. I can say, okay, well, there's something called red matter. I don't know how it works, but it exists.
It's red,
okay,
it's matter.
That's all great. What got me more... Yeah, what got me more was Spock's whole narrative when he mind-melds with Kirk about the supernovae, about how it was going to destroy Romulus, about how they built the ship and everything he needed to do. And I'm like, this makes zero sense scientifically.
Yes!
It makes no
Thank you.
And I expect from Star Trek, and maybe it's one of the reasons why I'm kind of middle of the road on, is this Star Trek or is it not Star Trek? And I expect better from Star Trek, personally, when it comes to science. You know, I don't expect them to be 100% accurate because we don't know enough about the universe yet to make stories about the 23rd, 24th century be interesting with our own science exclusively.
They don't need to be right, but they need to try.
They need to try. And what I love about the television series is that they actually had scientific advisors who were real scientists, and they actually would take the time to ask, we have this idea, this is going to happen. Can you write something here that makes sense, that we can reconcile with current theories?
Some kind
of sense. And sometimes they fudged it. Yeah, sometimes they fudged it a bit for creative license, but they did try to make it so it seemed plausible to us. And what I like about Star Trek is that that future seems real. And scientifically, it seems plausible that that would be our future. And this entire story and the whole incursion of Nero, which sets the timeline apart and creates the alternate timeline, and all of the crises that the crew have to overcome in the film are all based on this event of the supernova exploding. And it makes zero sense. It's like an enormous... It doesn't make any sense. It's just something created to set a plot in motion.
It makes less sense than a Genesis device or the Nexus or, I mean, come on.
But a Genesis device does make some scientific sense. If you think about our...
No, it makes significantly less sense than the Genesis device.
I'm just saying, though, that Star Trek has never been afraid of doing crazy things. I mean... Yesterday's Enterprise, that Enterprise just kind of comes through and then goes back with barely any explanation. And who cares how I got there? Because it's a great story. I don't care about the red matter. I don't care about the supernova. They're telling me a great story, and that's all that matters. And so when you write science fiction, it's science fiction for a reason. And sometimes Star Trek really relies on the science to make it more real. And sometimes it's just using it as a contrivance to tell a good story. And at this point, they're using it as a contrivance.
Well, the problem is that they use it as like seven contrivances. Like, it's not only the thing that destroys Romulus, like the supernova, and there's the red matter, and that's the thing that makes the quantum singularity, and that also makes the time warp, and that's why the Narada goes back in time, and there's also a time delay, which is why Spock arrives later. There's a million contrivances all built into one drop of red matter.
Yeah, it's almost a little too easy to write that, then. A little lazy. It's like a catch-all. I mean, the Genesis device didn't
the thing. Yeah.
And do that.
They explained the Genesis device. They were like, this is a complicated sci-fi thing. We're going to explain how it works, sort of.
And it had a very practical purpose. Yeah. Red matter is incredibly mysterious in its functionality. And what does it really do?
Makes things red.
They try to explain it, but I feel like they fall really short when you compare it to something like the Genesis device.
Yeah.
Or even the Nexus, where there has to be a suspension of disbelief, but it is science fiction, and who knows what's out there.
And the Nexus only does one thing. It's just a place out of time.
Right.
Whatevs.
Well, it does a lot more than one thing, because we don't understand the rest of what it does and how it even exists. It's just a contrivance to get to the story. I mean, so again, I don't think there's anything wrong with allowing them to tell a story. And if it tells a good story, then that's okay. You know, if it's telling a really bad story, but I don't think this is telling a really bad story. And I think if you think that, then that's fine.
I wouldn't object to the red matter, time warp, Narada thing if it was the only easy out. My problem is that the movie is sort of chock full of easy outs.
Well, and that's something that Kurtzman and Orsi talk about in this article that I was reading on MTV. They had given an interview and they asked questions, and a lot of people have been asking them about what they can saw as conveniences or contrivances in the story, and they specifically wrote them in there on purpose. You know, why does Spock end up on the planet where Kirk will get shot onto? Well, they talked about that. They wrote that there's a moon that as Nero's passing by, he leaves Spock there so he'll be able to see Vulcan be destroyed. And what happens? The Enterprise is going out of the system of where Vulcan was, and that's where Kirk gets jettisoned, and they do it on purpose. And that they said, too, the same thing with Scotty. How does Scotty end up, you know, he's the farthest person away from this crew. How does he end up on the ship? Well, their idea is that it's destiny. The timeline's trying to fix itself, and they kind of put the story into a little bit more of a mythological sensibility.
And then at the end of the movie, Spock says we're in a different timeline, all the rules are changed, but there's still destiny trying to fix things.
Well, and I like that they talk about this idea that the reason these characters are going to end up on the same ship is because something is pulling them together. Like, they belong together.
But nothing's pulling Vulcan from being blown up?
I think that that's a great storyline. So, I think that makes a lot of fun.
I think that if Destiny's keeping the crew of the Enterprise together and not looking out for the billions of Vulcans, that's a pretty crappy Destiny.
Well, I can see, you know, I do see that the idea that Destiny is bringing people together is something that I can accept. And now for them to say that they wrote that in on purpose is like saying, you know, like I was thirsty and I got myself a glass of water on purpose, because you're writing a story. You need Spock and Kirk to meet. Obviously, you're going to put that in the movie that he gets shot onto the same planet. I mean, it's kind of odd for writers to say that they did that on purpose. I think that all I would say is that I agree that this is a good story, and as a movie experience, I really like this movie. I really enjoy it. As a Star Trek movie, I like it a little bit less, and I just see these plot devices as being something more out of generic science fiction than being what I'm personally expecting out of Star Trek. And but again, I think it is because you have a group of writers who are, I do think they know Star Trek. A lot of fans say, oh, okay, JJ and Orci and these guys, they don't know Star Trek and they disrespect the canon and everything. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think they know it quite well, especially Orci and Kurtzman. But it's their first time writing Star Trek, and I feel like they're writing a movie, or they're just writing a TV show. They're not writing Star Trek, and they're taking a lot of easy outs just to move a story from point A to point B. And it disappoints me as a Star Trek fan, because I expect certain things. When I see the name Star Trek, I have certain expectations of what that entails. Mm-hmm. And
but I would,
I get some of those things in this movie, and then I don't get some of those things in this movie.
But I would say that those are the exact, sometimes same things that killed Star Trek in the first place, by putting so many, you know, borders around it and saying this is Star Trek and this isn't. You know, I mean, this is why, Chris, we love Deep Space Nine, because it breaks every freaking rule that Star Trek has, and it tells an awesome story and still manages to feel like and be the best Star Trek out there. This is why we like Deep Space Nine, because that's what it did. And when it did it really well, a lot of times it was breaking a lot of the Star Trek rules. You're writing a new movie for a new generation, and you're having to change Star Trek because Star Trek died. I mean, people stopped watching.
Star Trek didn't die.
Well, no, but I mean, people stopped watching Enterprise because,
well,
you know, Star Trek fans stopped watching Enterprise, and now they're the ones who want to bitch and complain about Star Trek 2009 not being Star Trek. Well, you didn't support Star Trek when it was on. So it's your fault that this is happening. So you have nobody to blame but yourself. And if you don't like this...
I blame the Romulans.
Yeah.
I always blame the Romulans.
Well, they are responsible. I mean, Nero is a Romulan, so... but I mean, that's... that. Again, I guess I am willing to let that go because I'm wanting more Star Trek. And even if it's not quite the same, I want it to be the best that it can be. I'm hoping that it continues to get better. But right. This is, like you said, this is the first time these guys are writing Star Trek. I got to give them a little bit of leeway because it's a big universe. It's a big way to get into it. And, you know, we read the comics, Chris, and we know how much these guys know Star Trek, because
right. It
is rife with so many great homages to all the series. And so... they're trying to make everybody happy, and that's a really hard thing to do.
And you can't.
And so,
well, that's the problem too, is that they're trying to make everyone happy.
Well,
they're trying to make the studio's bank account happy.
Right.
They're trying to make Star Trek fans happy. They're trying to make general moviegoers happy. You can't do it all.
The best thing that they did was what we talked about earlier, is that they give fans 700 plus hours of Star Trek and say this all still exists, and now we're going to do something a little bit different, and now for something completely different, a new Star Trek. And so I think that's probably the hardest decision that they had to make, and they made it work really well so that fans could have everything that came before and have something new at the same time.
I would say that I greatly prefer the J.J. Abrams film and the new continuity to Enterprise. So I'm a big fan of overwriting that period of history. I would very much like to forget that show.
You know, what would be interesting, I really think, and again, Matthew, like you said, we read the comics, and so we do know how well Orci and Kurtzman know Star Trek history and TOS. I think a lot of us believe that we're probably going to get an animated series a bit like The Clone Wars sometime in the next couple of years, produced by Bad Robot. It seems, I mean, nothing's been said for sure, but it seems like a likely thing to happen. And if that does happen, you know, the animated series that came after the original series had a lot of very good stories. You know, the animation wasn't great, But, you know, it had real stories. I mean, they were like actually written. There was some substance in those stories. What I would find interesting to see would be if these guys write an animated series of the Abramsverse where they actually can do a new show every week, what would they explore? And would they go into the places that people like me consider Star Trek that I'm feeling or lacking in the current film, if they actually had a television medium through which to explore those issues?
Well, and I think if Countdown to Darkness is any clue of what they might do with a animated series, I'm all for it. I mean, talking about all the big issues in Star Trek from a little bit different point of view and throwing in all sorts of great things from series in the past and, you know, the future, it's fantastic. So I would love if they did that. I think, you know, we all recognize Star Trek is really a TV medium, and there's no denying that. And they've had some great films, but those films are mostly held up because of what you've seen on the television show. And that's why they really work so well. I mean, without Space Seed, there's no Wrath of Khan. Wrath of Khan cannot exist without Space Seed. It's not going to happen. And I don't want everybody to think that's listening to this that I love everything about this movie. There's plenty of things that I'm not a fan of. I hate the new Enterprise. I think it looks stupid. The nacelles are too big. Like the lines look horrible. It looks like it was designed by a child who just started pulling things together. I mean, the engineering room is retarded.
It's a brewery.
Can we stop pretending that a brewery is okay? I mean, you know, so there's things that I don't like, but...
Okay, well, there's another topic that... there are a couple of other topics about the movie itself that I want to touch on before we run out of time. One of them relates to the environments. The ship design, I don't like the Enterprise, especially the exterior design. Matthew doesn't like it. Max, do you like the new Enterprise?
I have zero interest in the design of the Enterprise. I think that the original design was ridiculous. Okay. The new design looks better than the TV Enterprise, for sure. Maybe not better than the movie one, but... I mean, it's a ridiculous design.
The movie one is probably my favorite. And Char, what about you?
I don't
you?
Mind it. Completely neutral.
No. You don't mind it? All right. Going inside the ship, though, is the real question. And a lot of people hate the brewery engineering, the water tubes that Scotty gets sucked into. But if you look at the Kelvin, if you look at the Enterprise... What I do appreciate creatively, what J.J. Abrams is doing here, is that I appreciate the attempt to make these ships feel like actual functioning ships that you would actually build and that people would work on, because the starships, the Enterprise D, Voyager, these ships they're beautiful inside. I'd love to spend time on one. If I had to work on a starship, that's absolutely where I'd want to work. But I just don't think that that's the kind of ship that you would build and put out into space. What I like about Battlestar Galactica, the new Battlestar Galactica, is that those ships feel like real environments that people would build and they would work in, and that's what those ships would end up like. Don't say to me at all! And I do feel that the Kelvin and the Enterprise in this movie feel like real places. Well, they are real places. They went out and shot them. They just happen to be breweries and bread factories and places. But but I like the fact that it feels real. That helps me to feel like I'm in the situation. Like I can imagine that this is really happening and that someone has a camera and they're shooting this event from history or the future from our perspective that's actually taking place.
Yeah, I actually really like the bridge of the new Enterprise. I think, you know, they everything isn't a touch panel with some weird lacquers. You know, there are actually buttons and knobs and all these kind of things that you feel like do something. You know, you don't know what they do, but if you went on the Enterprise, you know, you could have Sulu tell you what all these things do, and you could they had some,
except for the parking brake.
Exactly, you know. That external internal dampener.
Inertial dampener.
Which doesn't make... Yeah, inertial dampener, which is really just a parking brake. But yeah, I do... I think that some of it works really well. And I do appreciate that they're trying to say that this is a real thing. You know, it reminded me a little bit of a cross between the movie Enterprise and kind of like also the Enterprise E. Just something about those two. It's like they put them together and came out with this. You know, because the Enterprise E, we saw some of those places where it wasn't so pretty, you know, and it wasn't so put together as we had seen, like on, say, the Enterprise D, where everything just looks like you're walking through a hotel the whole time.
Right. Yeah. I hadn't thought about the Enterprise E. That's interesting. I felt like it was more they were trying to do sort of what they did on Enterprise, the show, where they're trying to make it look a little more modern and sleek and yet true to the time according to Star Trek, making it look a little retro.
Yeah.
Where you've still got the buttons and the panels and Sulu's mm-hmm. going to use that knob to accelerate and things of that nature. And yet, I don't know. I'm one of those in the camp who thinks the bridge does look like the Apple Store, so I'm not a huge fan of the bridge either.
Well, the bridge redesign that they've, of course, I have not seen Into Darkness and I won't see it for months, but there have been photos and also the video game has the new bridge redesign in it. The bridge redesign looks fantastic because it still has the basic look of what we see in this movie, but they've added a bit more color to it, a bit more dark earth tones. It doesn't look as much like an Apple Store anymore. I mean, it's still obviously the same bridge. When you see it, you don't think, oh my God, they just completely redesigned the bridge of the ship. But they definitely looked at what they did this time and saw where they could improve upon it. And they improved it. I find it interesting on this Enterprise that the bridge is so squeaky clean and bright and futuristic. And the rest of the ship is like the dungeons of who knows what kind of factory.
The dungeons of Mordor.
Yeah, I felt like it was...
What they do in this movie, and it's another thing that it doesn't bother me too much because I want them to keep the movie moving along, but they make this Enterprise feel enormous. The engineering, everywhere they go, you feel like this is an absolutely enormous ship on the inside. But when they need to go somewhere, everything is so freaking close. Spock is, I don't know, in the shuttle bay and he wants to go to the bridge and it takes him, what, 2 seconds in the turbo lift? He like goes in and bzzz, oh, I'm on the bridge now. And then Chekhov needs to beam Kirk and Sulu before they hit the planet. I can do that. I can do that. And then he runs down the corridor and it's like asking someone, where's the bathroom? And they're like, go out the door. It's the second door on the right. That's where the transporter room was. Like everything is so close together when it needs to be in the story. And the rest of the time, it feels like it's a massive, massive engineering
project. I noticed that too. Yeah, the sets are larger than life, but when it comes to navigating the actual ship, no sweat.
It's mostly tubes. The stuff that isn't tubes is just like tubes. A few
water tubes, Jeffrey tubes.
Yeah.
90% of that ship is just giant tubes. Everything else is, you know, crew quarters, the bridge. And that's all like around
what
the
if the crew quarters are also tubes?
They're giant
like you
tubes.
Climb in, like the capsule hotels.
You live in tubes.
It's all tubes. It's made of tubes. They just order a bunch of tubes, slap them together.
I have a whole new concept and vision of what this thing looks like.
The whole Enterprise was built by Creo.
You know what I was really disappointed, though, is that, you know, walking around the Enterprise, there aren't a lot of aliens, and there were no Andorians. So this movie could not have an Andorian fight scene, and I was really disappointed because I would have loved to have seen JJ Andorians.
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
Totally. I think that was a majorly missed opportunity, and I'm really hoping we see at least one really good fight scene in Into Darkness.
Well, and I hope we see more of the, you know, kind of a JJ version of some of the other Star Trek aliens. You know, Earth isn't supposed to be the only people in Starfleet, and you don't really see any. I mean, there's Tellarites, there's Andorians, there's all these, you know, famous races. Man, add some of those in. You've got the money to do these really
well. They did have Keenzer.
Well, Well, that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, but...
But you are right.
Well, we've got to tread that line of not contradicting.
Right. But you are right. I mean, you would think that there must be Andorian officers on the ship. And if I'm sending two crew members down to that drilling platform to fight off Romulans, I'm totally sending two or three Andorians.
Who better?
Yeah.
Because would kick the Romulans' asses.
Totally.
Oh, yeah. And they would have all come back alive. I mean,
yes, they would have.
They would have.
And green blood all over them, smeared, you know, blood face paint, you know.
Take your blood back to Andoria.
Question two, though. If you're sending three people down to a drilling platform to blow it up, why do you give all of the explosive charges to one person? Wouldn't you give each person explosive charges?
That would make too much sense.
Or does that just make too much sense?
So instead you give it to the reckless security officer.
Yeah, he is... Oh, the engineer. He's an engineering officer.
Yeah, sorry.
So it made sense that he was carrying them, but still, I thought of that too, Chris. I was like, seriously? You're not going to split the charges up just in case? Because, you know, Pike right? says you got a 1 in a million shot, you know, of making this work.
They took Pike very literally. He said one, so let's just give them all to this guy.
Well, you know, Olsen chose the red suit.
Well, that's...
I mean, we got demo men in video games all over the place. In Die Hard, Heinrich had the detonators. Nobody else had the detonators. There's always one guy that's got them.
Yeah, classic.
Exactly. And the great scene with when they're on their way before they dive down to the platform and Olsen and Kirk and Sulu are sitting there and Olsen's like, can't wait to kick some Romulan ass. And Kirk just looks at him like, really? And he's like, oh yeah. I love that scene. He's so excited about it. I think that's a problem. He was so pumped that he couldn't control himself and actually take the time to pull his shoe.
He was an adrenaline junkie.
He'd had too much Andorian Red Bull and he was too jittery to pull the chute at the right time.
He was practicing his barrel rolls before they launched in the shuttle.
Andorian Red Bull literally gives you wings, actual wings that you can fly with.
Although I'm pretty sure that a Blue Bull is most popular.
Oh, that's totally true. Man.
For a second, I thought you were going to say something else, and I was like...
Okay, a couple of other quick topics here before we wrap this up, because I think we've been going for a good hour now. Performances in general. How do you feel about each actor in their role as an iconic character from the original series?
This was actually my biggest concern going into this movie before I went and saw it. I thought, who is going to be able to do this role without kind of almost being a mockery of it or doing an impression of the original actor doing the role? I just thought, this has got to be such a delicate balance.
Which was the big risk, right?
And so I was really worried that this was not going to work. Turns out, they did pretty freaking awesome. I was very happy with the cast.
For me, it's Pine when he's doing the Kobayashi Maru. He is so Shatner without mimicking Shatner.
Yes.
His movements with the apple, I mean, everything screams Shatner. That cockiness, the bravado, you buy that this man is James C. Kirk.
You know the other scene that does that for me, if I can interrupt you for a second, is at the very end, Kirk steps onto the bridge and he's kind of puffing his chest out and he's, bones! The way that Chris Pine does that is so incredibly spot on. I'm just like, yeah! Off you go! Next voyage!
And also to interrupt you, Matthew, because you mentioned the apple and the Kobayashi Maru situation. When I'm watching that as a Star Trek fan, I'm thinking, this is great. In The Wrath of Khan, they're in the Genesis cave. Kirk pulls out the apple. He eats the apple. He says, I don't believe in the no-win scenario. And I'm thinking, this is brilliant writing. They picked that up. They put it in here. They're showing us how he beat the Kobayashi Maru, and he's got the apple. But no, if you listen to them talk, Nope, not a reference. They say a lot of fans think that the apple's a reference to a famous original series episode, but it's not. We were just talking and we said, you know, I really hate it when actors eat apples in movies. And I'm like, you guys, you're telling me that that was coincidental? You missed that? Well, lucky accident for you, because as long as you don't listen to the commentary, you think that it was a great homage to the Genesis cave in the Wrath of Khan.
It's perfect.
Sadly, you find out that it was just a lucky accident.
And I think for me, the other one, beyond Quinto, who's fine, but nobody for me beat McCoy when, he comes on, his introduction is perfect. I mean, disease is, and space is diseased and danger wrapped in darkness and silence. And then Kirk turns to him and he's like, you know, Starfleet operates in space. I mean, but for me, the person who got the character the most and just felt like an extension of, you know, the same character was Bones. I think Carl Urban is just hands down the best of anyone to me in this film.
As a man, as a person.
Yeah. Well, even when he tells Kirk that she left me and all I have left are my bones, that was Carl Urban's line that he just made up on the spot. It wasn't in the script. And I think it shows that Carl Urban really understood that character that he was playing and Star Trek. You know, he knew what he was doing. I think Carl Urban is the closest in character-wise to the original character, but it still doesn't come off as being an imitation of DeForest Kelly. And I thought Chris Pine did a great job of being Kirk without being Shatner. It's just at the right moments he channels Shatner, but he doesn't. He's his own Kirk. He's his own character. And obviously, Quinto is playing a very different Spock than Leonard Nimoy did. Uhura is just a completely new character. I don't see very much Nichelle Nichols Uhura in what Zoe is doing at all. And same with Simon Pegg as Scotty, that I feel like I can see that it's Scotty, but it's not the James Doohan Scotty. You know, this is a Scotty who's like really excited and kind of surprised at himself that he can pull off these engineering feats, whereas the Scotty that we've known was a more experienced engineer who I think knew exactly what he was doing and never surprised himself in anything.
He feels like a young Scotty to me. He feels
That's what I was going to say, Scotty. Seems
like he would be. He's youthful. He's before the weight problem. He's got a lot of energy.
Yeah. It's running.
Yeah.
He's laughing.
And so he feels like Scotty, right, but just younger. And then Sulu feels like kind of a new character to me, more or less. And then Chekhov, I really buy what Yelkin is doing here. Is this is the 17-year-old Chekhov, since we didn't get to see Chekhov until he had been in Starfleet for a while and he shows up on the ship. And I thought everyone got the characters quite well. You know, I thought that Nurse Chapel was spot on in this movie.
Yeah, you didn't even see her.
Because you didn't see her, but Bones did ask her for something.
You know what was
missing? She was mentioned in the film.
Was Chapel, is she pining for Spock in this uniform, in this universe?
No, she's going to be pining for Kirk in this universe, I think.
There's going to be like some, maybe like...
Yeah. Her and Alice Eve will have a cat fight.
Some blonde love triangle going on.
Yeah.
Pining for pain.
Well, and you know what's really interesting about this movie, I think, too, is that all of these characters are younger versions of what we saw. You know, when we see them all in TOS, they're very established. They know who they are as characters. They're confident in what they can do. You know, this is them before that, where they're all still kind of unsure of themselves. And we kind of get to see them grow into what we'll know later on. And for me, too, I think that's what makes it really interesting, is that you know they're going to inch closer to what we know in the original series and in the films. But it's going to take a little bit. And I like finally getting to see them move into that position instead of just being introduced to them in those positions. That's fun, because I don't know that about these characters, at least in the Prime universe.
Right. Yeah, aside from major things like Kirk losing his father, these are essentially still a lot, by and large, the same characters that we know, but they are younger and therefore a little rough around the edges. They haven't quite come into how we know them yet, but we're going to see them get there, and that is exciting.
You know, on this, we've talked kind of through, you know, the pros and the cons of this. I think for me, the biggest pro has been this. Had a bunch of friends over last night. We watched the film, and one of the people had never seen the film before, and she had actually been put to sleep to it before. And we were like, no, Sarah, you have to watch this movie. You're going to love it, I promise. She watched the whole thing, and at the end, she's like, yep, that was good. I like that. I like that a lot. And I had another friend who I, you know, does another whole type of different podcasts for a different show on TV. I had her watch the film. She bought it on Blu-ray and she watched it. And I asked her what she thought. She's like, you know what? I really like the characters. I found everything really interesting. I'm sure there's probably a lot I didn't get because I haven't seen the show, but I really like it. And I think that that's what this is doing for Star Trek, is it's making new fans who are going to want to go back, I think, and find out what happened before. And that's great. I love that JJ's movie is making that happen. And so if anything comes out of this, it's that people are going to fall in love with Star Trek all over again. And I can't imagine anything better for the franchise. I mean, it's giving us all these remastered Blu-rays and everything because they want to capture that magic right now when people have it. Thank God for J.J. Abrams and his movie.
Well, that sounds like a final thought, Matthew.
I guess I'll make that my final thought, Chris. And I'll say that if I were going to have to rate this film, I would give it 9 out of 10 galas because there's nothing better than Orion in her underwear.
Even Alice Eve?
Wow.
I'm holding judgment till I review that film.
All right.
All right. Well, Shar, what's your final thought on the film?
I think, you know, for as tough of a position as J.J. Abrams and the writing staff were in to do Star Trek at this particular point in its time, you've got so many years of backstory. We mentioned not only is there all that and you want to please the fans, but you have to please the suits. You have to make money. You have to appeal to a general audience. Therefore, they had their work cut out for them. And given the circumstances, I feel like this was a really good, successful outing. Was it perfect? No, absolutely not. I felt like they got a lot of things right. A couple things wrong, like some things like the red matter and some of the science was a little it was just not quite there for me. I felt like some of it was BS. But you know what? When I first went to see this film, I was really excited about it. We didn't talk at all about the opening sequence where George Kirk sacrifices his life so that his brand new son and his wife and something like 800 people can survive from the Kelvin. The emotion in that scene, I mean, had the rest of that movie been as explosive as the opening sequence, holy whoa. I mean, that would have been the greatest movie ever made. But it started with such a bang and reined me in. I was really excited. I thought, yes, Star Trek is back, bitches. This is fantastic. And it was the kind of shot in the arm that the franchise really did need at the time, because I really do think that Star Trek was kind of at the end of a road for a little while before this movie. This injected some brand new life into it, for better or for worse. I know there's the haters out there, but there's also a lot of new fans. There are fans that have been with the franchise maybe on and off, or were with the franchise, fell off the wagon, and now they're back with all the things like the DVDs and Netflix, Blu-ray. And now with the new movies, it's only going to continue. So Star Trek has been given a brand new life. It's a resurgence. And I'm thankful for this movie for doing that. It's exactly what needed to happen to Star Trek. So it's not my favorite Star Trek movie by any means. In fact, if I were to rate this just as a action flick, I would say it's a fantastic movie. As a Star Trek movie, it's okay. It's kind of middle of the road for me. It's not at the top. It's not at the bottom. Therefore, I think I'm going to give it... I think I might give it 6.5 Keensers.
Wow. Half a Keenser is pretty small, though, because one Keenser is rather
half
small.
Half a Keenser and an apple.
All right. How about you, Max?
This movie, with its constant action and intensity of performance, it puts me to sleep. It's sort of hypnotically mindless. It reminds me of when I was a kid and I would break things for no reason, just because it was something to do. And to me, it feels sort of like a symptom of a very anti-intellectual society, that this is really great. And I don't understand it's a good action movie, but not a great Star Trek movie. I would say that, I would give more points in the Star Trek category, and outside of it, less. I would say that's a pretty bad action movie and a halfway decent Star Trek movie when you compare it to, like, Final Frontier or Nemesis. So I would say it's probably 3 broken lamps out of 11 completely not broken lamps.
3 out of 11. All right. Well, I'm going to... I look at this movie in 2 ways. And I do look at it as a movie and as a Star Trek movie as kind of 2 separate things. I agree with Matthew that one thing I love about it is that it has raised mainstream awareness of Star Trek to a level that we had not seen probably since the golden age of Star Trek in the 90s, when TNG was ending and Generations was being shot and DS9 and Voyager were on. And that's great. And I do hear from a lot of fans that they got into Star Trek after seeing this movie, which it's hard for me to wrap my mind around because I've been watching Star Trek since the 70s and watching TOS and reruns when I was a kid. There are people who are just now discovering Star Trek. And if this is a way for them to find out about Star Trek and then go back and discover the 726 episodes of Star Trek and films that came before this, then I think that's wonderful. I think, like Char said, they had a huge challenge here in putting this together. Now, I still can't help but question the need to reboot the franchise. And there's too much rebooting going on in Hollywood in general. And so when I found out they're rebooting Star Trek, I'm like, do we really need to do that? It just seems like these days that you have to reboot everything. And, I'm just waiting for the reboot of Bosom Buddies.
Yes!
Because you know it's coming.
That's what I want.
And it's going to happen. So
we need more men cross-dressing.
We do, because we need to generate more mainstream interest in cross-dressing, and I think that the reboot is going to do it. And one thing I know is that the new Susan B. Anthony Hotel, it's going to look a lot more real. It's not going to look like that cheesy, 80s sitcom set. It's going to look like a real hotel that people would actually live in. So I'm looking forward to
it. Is it going to be next to a brewery where they make their special beer that they run through all the time?
It is. It is. And in fact, Laverne and Shirley are going to be guest starring. They're going to be recasting them as well.
The best crossover
so
ever.
So we can look forward to that. But back to this movie, though. I think the actors did an excellent job in their performances. I can sit down and watch this movie and really enjoy it as a movie experience. If I try to watch it as a Star Trek movie, and if I look for everything that I expect out of Star Trek from it, I'm left mostly disappointed. I do find things in it. Matthew, you pointed a lot of them out. The conversations between Pike and Kirk, between Spock and Sarek as well, and the ones between Spock and Amanda are all great moments. And there's definitely stuff to be had in here. I just wish that I could see it fleshed out a bit more. So it kind of leaves me in a quandary. And so I'm actually going to give this film two ratings. I'm going to give it a rating as just a science fiction action movie. And in that case, I'm actually going to give this film 9 Budweiser classics. Nice. But as a Star Trek film itself, I'm only going to give it 6 Cardassian sunrises.
Good luck to whoever's figuring out our ratings.
6 Cardassian sunrises, those will mess you up.
Especially with a shot of Jack straight up. Will.
All right. Well, before we go, Max, tell everyone where they can find you around the network and elsewhere.
Well, we're on. I'm on Commentary Trek Stars with my co-host Mike, who is currently somewhere over the Atlantic or Europe somewhere, and we talk about the work of Trek creators outside of Trek and elsewhere on the internet. We are on Twitter at ComTrekStars. And on our website, commentarytrackstars.com, where we do movie commentaries and other random nonsense.
Excellent. And we should highlight that that's Commentary Track Stars on Twitter and your website, as opposed to Commentary Trek Stars, your show on Trek FM, which I believe was your idea.
We'll
naming,
have to just
right?
set up a separate Twitter account for Trek Stars, just so that we can deal with that eventuality.
Yeah. Because it's not confusing at all.
It confuses me on a regular basis, and I came up with both freaking names.
All right. And Char, tell everyone where they can find you.
All right. You can find me, of course, all over the place on Trek FM. I'm the managing editor, so I do a lot of managing and editing these days, especially with our influx of new writers. Thank you to everybody that applied. I've enjoyed talking with you so far, and we've got some things in the works already. And, of course, you can find me on To the Journey.
To the journey!
To the journey! To it.
Tardy. Next time. You can find me with my lovely co-hosts, Lori and Tristan, and we talk all things Star Trek Voyager. And then I am on Twitter. My handle is Oh the Profanity.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys. It was fun to talk about Star Trek 2009.
Good discussion.
It was fun.
Chris, that was a fantastic discussion of Star Trek 2009, JJ's version of Star Trek. I think we got to talk about a lot of things that fans maybe have missed or just, you know, haven't really talked in depth about this film as much as it should be, because there's a lot you can talk about that isn't just, oh, I hate the brewery and, oh, I don't like that it doesn't have any messages and yada, yada, yada. But what we really missed, Chris, was where was Jeffrey Combs?
He is everywhere.
I know. They got in a lot of the classic Star Trek references. I don't know if you noticed, but when Kirk is riding his motorcycle and he's heading over to where they're building the Enterprise and he passes by a sign and the sign says SFC Division, United Federation of Planets, Sector 47. And so they got those things in there, but there's no Jeffrey Combs. Come on, guys.
Yeah, I just don't know how you could miss the Combs, and I mean, it would have been perfect. We already talked about the fact that they didn't have Andorians, and they could have just had him as an Andorian, and it would have been great.
It would have been perfect, yeah. But yeah, I agree. It was a fun discussion. There are lots of points about the movie that we didn't touch on. There were even some points that I had outlined for us to talk about that we didn't get to because we talked about various other things. But, you know, there's a lot to talk about in the movie, and I watched the movie again last night, and I found that I enjoyed it more than I remembered, and I did notice more elements in it, as you talked about, you know, with the father issues and such, you know, that are topics of Star Trek that I expect to be discussed in Star Trek, and they are there, and so I did enjoy it. I'm going to reserve judgment on JJ's Star Trek until it's all done, until I see Into Darkness and what comes after. I've been appreciating the comics and what we're getting filled in there. So at any rate, you know, just as we did with the motion picture on the Ready Room when we talked about that, I think that we gave 2009 a fair shake and we talked about its strengths and its weaknesses. And I'm glad that we had a chance to do that today.
Well, and Chris, I think one of the things that I remember is that, you know, Nicholas Meyer came in, not a fan, made an incredible movie. But Nicholas Meyer also had the ease of being able to use Space Seed as a background. You know, JJ and the writers, they're not able to use any of that stuff because they're trying to create a whole new universe but still be the same. But, you know, for Meyer, it could have been just a one-shot wonder. But then he came and he did my favorite Star Trek film, which is The Undiscovered Country. And I knew that it wasn't just a mistake. You know, that movie still has a couple of issues. You know, I don't really know why you bake food in an actual, you know, kitchen in the future like that when right. We've already seen that they have dispensers for food. And then anyway, but, right. You know, really cemented the fact that Meyer knew what he was doing with Star Trek. I'm hoping that Star Trek Into Darkness is going to do that for JJ and the writers here, that they know what they're doing because we've seen the second billing. And the second movie is hard. Yeah. So I think it's going to be good.
Yeah. Well, everyone will be finding out just right after this Ready Room drops, as all you guys over in the States get Into Darkness at last. And but until then, let's tell everyone where they can contact us if they want to share their thoughts on Star Trek 2009, on the J.J. Abrams take on Star Trek, anything we talked about in news. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. You can join in a larger conversation and start one, if you like, on our forums at trek.fm/forums. You'll also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And, of course, on Twitter, under username TrekFM. And, Matthew, what if people would like to look you up personally?
Well, if you'd like to look me up, of course I am on Twitter. It's MattRushing02. I'll be trying to keep it spoiler-free for Into Darkness. I'll be seeing it on Wednesday. If you want to know if the film is good or bad, I'll tell you that. If you want to know specifically things about the film, you're going to have to DM me. I'm not going to ruin it for people on Twitter. I'm not that guy who's just going to shout out, "Dumbledore dies," you know, right after they get the book. And so also you can find me on the network. I do Literary Treks with you, Chris, where you talk about books and comics. I do The Orb with you, where we do all things Deep Space Nine. And again, of course, write the book reviews. So as soon as the audiobook for Into Darkness comes out, I'll get that and review that. And that'll be your first audiobook review on the network as well. So that's exciting. But Chris, if somebody wants to find you and lament with you because they're in Japan and they're not getting Into Darkness until like 2015, where can they find you?
That's right. Yeah. You can find me on Twitter. My username is C Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that username. And give me a follow and say hello. Send me a net reply. But please don't send me messages about Into Darkness and don't ask me questions about Into Darkness because, as Matthew just said, I will not be getting the movie until August 23rd. I'm not expecting that I can avoid spoilers. And in fact, I know some spoilers and I've known them for a long time and I haven't said anything about them. But nevertheless, I don't want to know any more than I already know about the movie. And but I'll be glad to talk to you about the rest of Star Trek and about music and Japan and design and college football and anything else you want to talk about. So hit me up there. And Matthew, we'd also like to invite everyone to visit iTunes. Leave us a rating and a review if you like the show. We'd love to hear from you, and it helps other people find the show as well in the mysterious workings of iTunes. And lastly, we'd like to invite you to support our sponsor, Squarespace. Squarespace is absolutely the best all-in-one platform for building a personal blog, a website, a portfolio, or an online store. You get the web's best CMS, the web's best, most reliable hosting, all for a super low price. And as a Trek FM listener, you can save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. Just go to squarespace.com/trek and use offer code TREK5. To save 10%, you'll be helping us bring this programming to you every week and supporting our sponsor at the same time. Well, Matthew, I think we should let everyone go. We have held people in the show for a very long time this week, so I'm going to go out and see what I can find in the kitchen, and I'm going to take the Enterprise turbo lift there, so it's only going to take me probably about 2 seconds.
Sounds like a really good idea, Chris. Hopefully you can find something delicious. But you know what? It's time to stick an Orion cadet uniform in it, because the Ready Room is done.